Blog Talk Radio.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, September 26, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up in Washington, a coalition of senators introduces a bill to rein in NSA spying and open up the secret federal surveillance court to more review. Amid rampant sectarian attacks in Iraq, activists and residents gather in Baghdad for the first Iraqi social forum focusing on peace and justice as the country moves forward. And we continue our series on the Mexican border city of Ciudad Juarez, where residents are using murals, hip-hop, and other art forms to confront years of violence. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. A court in Florida has granted a retrial to Marissa Alexander, a woman sentenced to 20 years in prison for firing what she calls a warning shot over the head of her husband during a domestic dispute. She had a legal permit to possess the gun and had previously been hospitalized after incidences of domestic violence. Alexander's case came to national attention because of the disparity of her sentence and the acquittal of George Zimmerman, who shot and killed Trayvon Martin. Alexander was denied immunity by the court under the controversial Stand Your Ground self-defense law, and that ruling will stand. But the court today granted a retrial, saying the jury was improperly instructed on the issue of self-defense. Next Tuesday, health insurance marketplaces all over the country will open as one of the main provisions of the Affordable Care Act goes into effect. Uninsured people will begin shopping ahead of a March 31, 2014 deadline to be insured. Earlier this summer, the Obama administration issued a memo saying it would be illegal for insurers that receive federal funds to deny health coverage to transgender people, a revelation cheered by rights advocates. But how that will play out in the coming months is still far from clear. In Colorado's health exchange, there are now two insurers that will offer coverage to the state's transgender residents. Kaiser Permanente made the announcement this week, joining the nonprofit Colorado Health Op. Transgender people have historically had a difficult time finding health coverage, says Courtney Gray with the GLBT Community Center of Colorado.
Several years ago, on the individual market, I applied to every single health insurance company in the state of Colorado. I didn't qualify for low income. And every other health insurance company, when they found out that I was transgender, decided not to cover me at all.
Earlier this year, the Colorado Division of Insurance issued a bulletin that state anti-discrimination law does apply to health insurance, and therefore plans must cover the same services for transgender people as they would for others. Consequently, all health insurers must offer coverage to the transgender population, but only two in Colorado have done so up to this point. A Russian court said today that most of the Greenpeace activists who carried out a direct action at a Gazprom oil rig in the Arctic last week will wait in jail while an investigation into piracy charges is carried out. Among the group was a photojournalist who was documenting the action. The decision spurred protests in Moscow. FSRN's Katrina Danilova reports.
So far, the court has ordered the jailing of 9 Greenpeace activists and a photojournalist for 2 months. 3 others will be held for 3 days while they await a hearing. Other cases are still pending as of press time. The court said the activists need to be jailed because if released, they may continue criminal activity, destroy evidence, or flee the country. Roman Dolgov is one of the jailed activists. Speaking in court, he said any charges of piracy or attempts to take over the platform would be nonsense.
Greenpeace have been carrying out peaceful, nonviolent protests for the 30 years of its existence. The organization is founded on the principles that there will be no use of weapons, or threat of using weapons, or threats of violence.
Supporters held a protest at the investigative committee office in Moscow today. Many held signs demanding the release of the photojournalist. Russian investigators responded to the court decision by saying the pre-charge jail times could be reduced. The Greenpeace activists could still face criminal charges depending on the outcome of the investigation. Екатерина Данилова, ФСРН, Russia.
And finally, dozens of Nepalese workers in Qatar have died over the past months and often, quote, face exploitation and abuses that amount to modern-day slavery, according to an investigative report by the Guardian newspaper. The workers are largely employed as part of a construction boom ahead of the 2022 World Cup. The migrant workers are recruited in Nepal with promises of good wages in Qatar, but end up owing the recruiters large sums of money. Once in the Middle East, the investigation found the workers were denied food, had their wages withheld, and travel documents confiscated. A FIFA vice president is calling for the International Soccer Governing Body to launch an immediate investigation. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Washington today, the Senate Intelligence Committee questioned the leaders of the NSA and Office of National Intelligence about surveillance of U.S. citizens and foreign nationals, conduct revealed by former intelligence contractor Edward Snowden. The hearing comes as a bipartisan coalition of U.S. senators introduces a bill to strip away some of the intelligence community's powers to sweep up vast amounts of Americans' data. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
The Intelligence Oversight and Surveillance Reform Act would prohibit the government from continuing the bulk collection of domestic email and phone records, close the loophole that allows for searching electronic communications without a warrant, and force the government to disclose how these powers have been used in the past. Colorado Democrat Mark Udall is one of the authors of the newly introduced bill.
These aren't vague or abstract threats to our liberty. These kinds of things are happening right now as we speak. Right now, innocent people all over Colorado, all over our country, are among the millions of Americans who are having their private records collected under these programs.
Another provision, written by Connecticut Democrat Richard Blumenthal, would reform the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, a body that meets in secret to debate and rule on major interpretations of surveillance law.
There needs to be a constitutional advocate to make sure that the process is adversarial like every other court in the United States of America. You know, when you think about it, secret courts were one of the reasons that we rebelled as a nation against the English. Star Chambers became a symbol of our reason for revolution. And secrecy should be really an anathema to our judicial process, and certainly where secrecy is accompanied by only the government being heard, it can lead to abuse.
The coalition behind this bill told reporters this week that they have serious momentum, but their Senate colleagues are writing competing bills.
We are in the process of tightening up the FISA law.
That's California Democrat Dianne Feinstein, who chairs the Intelligence Committee and who's been an outspoken defender of the government's spying programs. She's currently writing legislation she admits doesn't go far enough for some people, a bill that would put limits on bulk domestic surveillance but keep the program in place. She told FSRN she thinks the outrage over recent revelations of government surveillance is overblown, and that private sector surveillance, like Google Maps, is a more appropriate target for protest.
And when I look at all the intrusions on the private sector that no one complains about, facial recognition, lack of privacy in many areas, your home is out there whether you want it to be or not, the privacy standards in the private sector have changed substantially, it seems to me.
One of the main witnesses at Thursday's hearing was NSA Director Keith Alexander, who asked the committee not to take away his agency's surveillance powers, saying they were vital for national security.
NSA's programs have contributed to understanding and disrupting 54 terror-related events. This was no accident. This was not coincidence. These are the direct results of a dedicated workforce, appropriate policy, and well-scoped authorities created in the wake of 9/11 to make sure 9/11 never happens again.
But Senator Udall, a member of the Intelligence Committee who has access to many classified documents, challenged these assertions.
It has never been proven to Senator Wyden or me that any of the bulk collection has provided uniquely valuable intelligence that's resulted in the disruption of any plots. You hear the number 54 plots being disrupted and on. That does not stand up to scrutiny.
Udall said he and the bill's other supporters may attempt to attach it to the National Defense Authorization Act, which must be passed before the end of this year. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Lawyers representing a group of California prisoners are in an Oakland federal court today in an attempt to win class action certification for a lawsuit challenging the state's use of solitary confinement. This comes just weeks after prisoners ended a two-month hunger strike protesting prison conditions. FSRN's Christina Anastad reports.
Attorneys for the prisoners filing the Asher v. Brown lawsuit claim Pelican Bay Prison Security Housing Unit, or SHU, violates the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. They want the lawsuit to apply to all SHU prisoners who have been in solitary confinement for more than 10 years. Jules Lobel is president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and lead counsel in the suit.
To put people in small little cells with no windows, no phone calls, no programming, no real recreation, and keep them there for 20 to 25, 30 years is torture. It's mental torture. It shouldn't be allowed in a civilized society, and the Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and inhumane treatment.
Lobel argues the SHU also violates the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment rights to due process of prisoners who are serving indeterminate sentences in the SHU because of their alleged gang affiliation.
Are they keeping people in this solitary who have committed crimes in prison, who have murdered somebody or assaulted somebody? In fact, they haven't. People are being kept in these conditions simply because of an association with a gang. And that's the fundamental issue that my clients object to.
Some SHU inmates, like plaintiff Ronnie Dewberry, have been in there for decades because of literature and art prison officials deem gang-related. Dewberry's sister, Marie Levine, says her brother's not an associate or member of a gang.
They arbitrarily labeled him as a gang member because he read a book, George Jackson book. You have allowed a book in a prison that you say is contraband, and then you allow my brother to read it to label him as a gang member? Something's wrong with that picture.
The California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation declined to comment on the pending litigation, but the state's motion to dismiss, filed earlier this year, denies the allegations that the SHU is cruel and unusual punishment. The state also argues that a new security threat group and step-down program provides due process and offers prisoners a way out of the SHU, even if they're believed to be gang members. If the judge allows the lawsuit to become a class action, plaintiff's attorneys are requesting the trial begin next year, while the state wants to delay it to 2015. Christina Onnestad, FSRN, California.
This is Dorian Marina, FSRN's anchor, with an important announcement. Due to a serious lack of funding, FSRN must cease production of our daily news program. Our last daily show is this Friday, September 27th. To our listeners and stations, thank you for all your support over the last 13 years. For more details about what's next for FSRN and to stay in touch, please visit our website, fsrn.org. Today in Baghdad, local residents, youth, labor groups, women's rights advocates, and activists from across the region and the world gathered for the opening day of the first Iraqi Social Forum. The event is bringing people together at a difficult time for the country. Just today, a series of bomb explosions hit public markets in and around Baghdad, killing more than two dozen and wounding scores more. It's the latest in a series of sectarian attacks that, according to the UN, has claimed some 4,000 lives in the past 5 months. But participants at today's forum are offering hope and resistance under the slogan, "Another Iraq is Possible, an Iraq of Peace, Human Rights, and Social Justice." For more, we go to Baghdad to speak with Nadia al-Baghdadi, one of the organizers of the forum. Welcome to FSRN.
Well, thank you. Thanks a lot. Thank you for having me.
We're reaching you just as the first day of the event is getting underway. Describe the opening ceremony that just took place.
The ceremony was combined between speeches and some bands who came and performed their acts, and it was a mix of international solidarity and some fun and some joy. People were dancing and singing and bouncing around, and we received solidarity from different parts of the world. It was the ultimate thing of the day. It was so wonderful.
Your slogan for the event is "Another Iraq is Possible." What is your vision for your country?
Well, another Iraq is possible with peace, social security, and justice. So we are looking for better distribution for wealth. We are looking to another political system that will do justice all Iraqis. And we are looking for more participants for the civil society in drawing our policy in the country and participate to making decisions in the country.
So groups at the forum have identified some specific issues that Iraqis face: unemployment, poverty, access to medical care and education. But you're also pointing to issues that we don't often hear about, such as artistic expression, freedom of the press, labor and trade union rights. Nadia al-Baghdadi, you are also particularly involved in environmental concerns yourself. Tell us more about the Save the Tigris campaign and the Iraqi Marshes campaign.
It's a problem that's been persisting ever since the 50s of the previous century. Iraq has been torn apart by political crises and wars. This very vital issue has never been set to the right course. We are a downstream state. So we have our water from another country, from outside our border. And in this case, we don't have control over our resources, our water resources.
The Social Forum is also unusual because it is featuring the voices of young people. What is the role that youth, that students, that young people are playing in this movement?
Well, actually, the ISF is an open space to open up to others and to ourselves, among us ourselves. And it's a unique event that is happening for the first time in Iraq. Actually, most of these young people have a hard time getting permission to perform their campaigns. So this is the first time ever in Iraq that we have this open space to express ourselves. Life is very limited to young people here in Iraq, but we are still trying and they are still pushing, and I'm so proud of all of them.
Now, the U.S. formally withdrew combat forces in 2011. The false and misleading claims of weapons of mass destruction from the Bush administration before the U.S. invasion in 2003 again came back recently to the public focus during the debate over possible military action in Syria. How do you see the legacy of U.S. involvement in Iraq since the invasion in 2003, and what would you like to see from the U.S. now?
Well, the U.S. invasion turned up our state completely without finding any other solution. I mean, they took apart so many foundations in the Iraqi state without getting replacement, and they did that. They should have the responsibility to build concrete foundations instead to replace them, but they didn't. We have a heritage of civilization, we have a heritage of culture, and we didn't come from nowhere. We are people we go very deep in history, and we have our construction that we were building for so many thousand years. But now everything is gone because of the policies of the U.S. Administration over the years. And it's not just the war. It's been the blockage at the beginning and then the war. So we are mentally disrupted. We are, I don't want to get so very emotional about this, but I really have faith. Had you been today with us during the open ceremony and watching our young people, I'm so proud of them. And I'm sure that in 10 years from now, will be much better than we were 10 years ago.
Nadia al-Baghdadi joined us from Baghdad, where the first Iraq Social Forum opened today. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And you can find a link to the program and other information about the Iraqi Social Forum on our website, fsrn.org. Today, we continue our coverage from the Mexican border city of Ciudad Juarez, which became notorious for drug war violence years ago due to a dramatic 4-year spike in homicides. While the Mexican government threw weight and money behind ambitious short-term recovery programs, it did not fund initiatives aimed at preventing another spike in violence. In the first part of our series, we looked at community efforts to address the trauma of living through violence. Now we examine other ways grassroots leaders are using creative energy and the role of arts in the wake of a collective tragedy many residents are still grappling to understand. FSRN's Shannon Young reports.
Despite its large population and importance as an economic engine and manufacturing hub, Ciudad Juarez has relatively few cultural institutions. The area's museums number in the single digits, and publicly funded centers for the arts are concentrated in the more privileged areas of the city's massive urban sprawl.
La ciudad padece segregación socioespacial.
In a shared office at a local university's sociology department, arts promoter and activist Leobardo Alvarado says Ciudad Juarez suffers from socio-spatial segregation. He points to a series of maps on the wall showing how the most marginalized areas of the city are virtually cut off from cultural opportunities and public spaces, including parks and plazas, which can be appropriated for cultural uses. The distance, leisure time, and transportation costs required to get from a poor outlying colonia to a cultural event downtown can be demotivating. But there are other ways of appropriating public space. Jorge Perez is a muralist better known as Yorch. He's part of the 10-year-old Resiste Art Collective and created a series of works around the Salvarcar neighborhood where he lives. In 2009 and 2010, he painted a couple of large murals outside of his grandparents' bakery, alluding to the violence and tension racking the city at the time. Yorch says lack of security during those years forced him and other graffiti artists to keep a low profile and stick to well-known areas. Yorch was later invited to paint murals with a group of kids in the Palo Chino neighborhood as part of a short-lived government-funded arts initiative.
We couldn't handle the demand. The people in the neighborhood loved it because they did not have anything like this type of work there. When they saw the first mural, some woman came over and said, "I have a wall, and it's all tagged up, and I like what you painted here. Can you do something over there?" And we go, and that woman would tell someone else. We painted the walls of the first people who came to us. We had 5 places to paint as part of the project, but many more wanted us to paint theirs.
Palo Chino is in the western district of Ciudad Juarez, known as El Poniente, a sprawling labyrinth of hillside neighborhoods and unpaved roads identified by the local university's cultural mapping project as needing urgent attention. Teresa Almada, who runs the Casa Promoción Juvenil Youth Center in El Poniente, says the violence hit the district hard and left deep scars, and that the underlying issues haven't improved.
The conditions of poverty, abandonment, and violence have remained and are now worse than they were during the bloodshed of the recent past. And we find it worrisome that officials are so quick to celebrate without acknowledging that if Juarez went through those experiences, it was in part due to an accumulation of huge vacuums of social rights.
El Poniente has a large youth population, but proportionally few middle and high schools. Institutional abandonment and lack of living wage opportunities have helped to swell the ranks of local street gangs, the entry level into organized crime. Many adult residents work long hours in the foreign-owned assembly plants, while few schools offer extended day programs. Casa is one place where youth can go for afternoon activities. Almada says arts and sports programs are always in demand, but there's also a common need among local youth to be heard, to build friendships and solidarity networks, and to receive support for small initiatives they develop within their communities. Youth-led programs developed around the elements of hip-hop have become so popular that Casa built its own recording studio for in-house production of music and CDs. Eric Ponce coordinates Casa's rap program.
Rap is a device which provides multiple tools, another language with new words for describing the world in which you live, and not just to describe, but also to act out. Just as a song can transform you into whatever you want, you start acting like it in real life. A lot of kids have used it to work through their process of grief, which can be very intense.
Ponce references a set of tracks produced by Mera Clase, a rap group in which he and other CASA members participate. In a song called Perdón, a young boy describes the confusion and anger he felt when his father was killed.
Forgiveness is the good guy's revenge. Don't let that poison destroy you. Then he says, I lost my father, but I invite you to forgive.
Both Ponce and Almada say the culture of rap is so strong in El Poniente that the hip-hop program and events associated with it have attracted at-risk youth into CASA's other programs, like continuing education and middle school dropout prevention.
Hay una gran explosión cultural en este momento en Ciudad Juárez.
Writer Elpidia Garcia says Ciudad Juárez is witnessing a great cultural explosion as part of a larger catharsis. Garcia herself turned to writing short stories to combat depression after she was laid off from her maquila job of 25 years. She says creative minds in Juárez are trying to make sense of what continues to be a relatively fresh wound in the city's psyche, and that fiction provides a flexible medium for telling stories based on real-life experiences. But like many involved in the Juárez cultural community, Garcia expressed reservations about whether the local administration will commit to long-term programs where they're most sorely needed.
Pero es que es tanto lo que hay que hacer, tanto, que...
So much needs to be done that it could take many years. And hopefully they'll do it right, because what often happens here is that they'll do something so that it'll appear in the press and thereby try to convince people, especially investors, of progress. But what's most important is to get at the root, to those living in poverty, and to the victims most affected by what's been happening.
Pobre a la gente que está siendo victimizada por todo lo que está sucediendo.
The federal government, under former President Felipe Calderón, funded recovery efforts in the city, which included infrastructure like sports fields and community centers. The program known as Todos Somos Juárez received mixed reviews locally, and the funding for it ended when the new administration took office in December. Many cultural initiatives in Juárez survive on grant money or on the backs of committed volunteers. While this falls short of what comprehensive official violence prevention programs could accomplish, community members say these small-scale efforts do their part to reconstruct the social fabric in what was once the world's deadliest city. Shannon Young, FSRN, Ciudad Juárez.
This is the second part of a series from the border city of Ciudad Juárez. To listen to the first part from reporter Shannon Young, go to FSRN.org. And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
She was absolutely innocent of any wrongdoing in the fraud case and in the dozens of other criminal proceedings against him. Protesters and police clashed across Greece on Wednesday as thousands demonstrated against fascism following the murder of a leftist musician by a suspected neo-Nazi. Police fired tear gas at protesters in Athens, the northern city of Thessaloniki, and the western city of Patras amid heightened tensions following the killing early Wednesday. 23 people were arrested, The anti-fascist protests came as around 20,000 people marched peacefully in Athens, Thessaloniki, and other cities during a two-day strike called by the Civil Servants Union. They were protesting against a job redeployment scheme demanded by Greece's EU-IMF creditors that is likely to bring additional layoffs in the recession-hit country.
The German government says successive administrations approved the deliveries of tons of chemicals to Syria that can be used for either peaceful purposes or to make sarin gas. The deliveries took place between 2002 and 2006 under the government led by former German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder and then that of current Chancellor Angela Merkel in her first term. The chemicals were exported for non-violent civilian use but can be also used for military purposes. The admission by the German government came following a request by the...
You are listening to the Internet Radio broadcast of the Intelligent Aboriginal News Service.
You get that special feeling then when you're piling up the bombs. There's no business like war. Business is the best business they know. Multinational profits going through the sky. They multiply while children die. So they run out by food and clothes for everyone.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
Statistics, but there's one which is so devastating, I have to cite it here. As you know, Bill, tracking has come back into schools again. It's become a sort of fashionable way of segregating kids within a single school. Black children, statistically, are three times as likely to be tracked into so-called special classes for the retarded as white children, but only half as likely to be put into gifted programs. That is an intolerable statistic in a democracy. And anybody who looks at that and all the other statistics, the fact that black infant mortality is twice that of white children, anyone who looks at those kinds of statistics, or a recent news event, black Haitians being brutally excluded from this country while white Europeans are welcomed at New York International Airport. Anyone who looks at that knows in their heart that racism remains the central moral agony of this society.
Yeah. So my pleading to Mr. Bin Wahad and to Dr. Keyes, in the white liberal tradition of, gee, you don't totally dislike us, do you, is a rather empty kind of...
Well, I think it is, Phil, because not to criticize you, naturally, I'd like to feel, you know, I'm a nice guy, I hope black people will like me, but that's wasted energy. The issue isn't whether they like you and me or not. The issue is whether they have an even shot in this society, and they can't afford to worry about our injured feelings.
Yes, I have...
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for Indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! You guys have no jurisdiction here.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What dumb did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligence Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. White man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet Radio
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Inteligente Indigena.
Ideal of integration and living together and cooperating. I ask you, not because I'm an insecure person who wants to be loved, I have children who must live in the society.
Edwards is the one who spoke eloquently to the point, and that is America herself. America herself will not survive in the 21st century unless she comes to tap into the diversity that is hers and stop pursuing this kind of divisive policy. This is more of a threat to the future of America than anything ever posed by the old USSR. We will explode from within unless we all understand we have a stake in this system. And that's the compelling issue, not whether we like each other, not whether we love each other, not whether it ever started out right, not whether we should be angry with anybody. We won't survive unless we understand we're in it together.
Appreciate very much your comments, Mayor Kelly, and I promise I shall not for the rest of the program ask any member of this audience or panel whether they like me.
The dialogue that we had before we decide whether we like white people or not, I think we have to begin to develop strategies and techniques for negotiating our differences over a very broad canvas. And this is going to mean the life and death of many of us. I've worked in the New York City public schools and seen the speed and dispatch with which a naughty boy quickly becomes a retarded boy. It's simply a matter of taking him out of the class on the wrong day and putting him in another class.
What we're talking about here is very clear. If you look at Latin America today, in every society in Latin America, and Latin America is essentially a conglomeration of European settler states. The conquistadores went in there and did the same thing that the English did here and everything, right? When we look at the compositions of these societies, we see that at the top are light-skinned descendants of conquistadores, and at the bottom are native people and black descendants of Africans. White skin privilege is a European ideal and a concept that was exported with their economic system, their religious philosophy, and it was exported and imposed on people of color. So when we talk about Latinos, let's understand what we're saying here. We're talking about Latinos who, for the most part, have African blood in them, and they have internalized racism just like everybody else. When we look at Asian Americans, many of the Asians came here initially came to work the railroads. They were treated like dogs. They were treated like dirt. But when we see a lot of Asians that come to the United States today, one of the first words they learn in their lexicon, one of the first things that they learn is nigger.
The United States' major contradiction around the issue of race is white skin male privilege. And if we don't attack that, if we don't analyze that, if we don't begin to deal with that, then we got a problem. And I totally disagree with the mayor of Washington, because I do not have a stake in saving a racist nation. I do not have a stake in maintaining American hegemony over people of color around the world. I do not have an interest in maintaining this system that causes the miseries of billions of people one more month.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to walk away from our investment in this country and the suffering that we've had in this country since 1619. We gave this country her culture. We gave this country her music. We gave this country her marginal profits of the agricultural revolution, though we never got our 40 acres and a mule. I'll be doggone if I'm walking away from 4 centuries of investment in this country. We, too, are entitled to a piece of the rock. I don't care how wrong America was.
Internet radio for smart original.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the fourth world from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Salutan and peace to all the original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, Angry Indian, editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the fourth world from ang-newswire.blogspot.com and aboriginalnewswire.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com. Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous news, thought, and analyses concerning the issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under imperial, theological, racist, neoclassist, neocolonialist, neoliberal, neofascist, and neo-misogynist control. I wish to welcome you all to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, welcome along. I wish peace to the gods and earths and love and solidarity to the entire original indigenous family in this time of strife and struggle. I'm your host, Angry Indian, and I'm here with our executive producer and engineer, Guadalupe Morales. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of things we could talk about. We have an interview coming up with Malachi Daniels that is really, you know, if you're into Afrocentric thought, you know, without boundaries, I think you're really going to enjoy what this brother has to say. And, you know, we're going to get to that later. But, you know, in the meantime, you know, I'm going to try not to talk too much because I really want you to hear this interview. But there's a couple of things I want to bring up, though, before we get into this. There's something going on. Now, if you don't see this or don't want to see this, then really, I don't have a whole lot of time for you. And frankly, you might as well stop this internet radio broadcast right now, because you're not going to want to hear what I have to say, the interview, or anything else that goes on here with, you know, Aboriginal Press News Service Public Radio. Because, African people, my brothers and sisters of the Afro diaspora, if you're not aware that there's a international plan to remove us from the scene, then, you know, I don't know what to say to you. I really don't know what to say to you. You know, we're not talking about fucking conspiracy theories and what have you. You know, conspiracies fucking exist. Now, for anyone here, conservative, what have you, you know, black, white, whatever the fuck you might be, and, you know, especially those conservative natives, and we're going to touch about that for a moment too, before we take a break. You know, if you're not looking around and opening your eyes and putting the blunts down and what have you, and I'm being serious about that, some of you, I understand life is tough out here, but you can't remove yourself from the world, man. You got to deal for what the fuck is going down. And what's going down is that they are seriously, when I say they, you know, I'm not just talking about white people, because there's a lot of folks that are brown who are down with this program. There is a program to remove the African from the planet. Now, if you think I'm kidding, if you think I'm going on some sort of, old time nigga shit, right? Let me explain something to you, partner. Look around here. Now, we had a brother, Jonathan Farrell. Now, those of you who are in the football should remember him. You know, he was what? You know, he's a Florida A&M, you know, well-known. You know, all, I mean, he was 24 years old. But, you know, as we like to say in terms of Trayvon Martin, he was one of the good ones. Isn't that what we say about Oscar Grant? You know, he was good to his family, what have you. He was one of the good ones. Well, what about Sean Bell? Wasn't he one of the good ones? Derrick Jones was running the business. Wasn't he doing okay? Wasn't he one of the good ones? How about Iana Jones? She didn't live long enough to be judged. You dig what I'm saying? And it's like, you know, here it is. We have all of these brothers. Every 28 hours, another brother is being listed as a statistic in the news. And here we have a brother, Jonathan Farrell, a good one. Something happened on the road. He lost control of his vehicle. He had an accident. He was obviously injured, but he was trying to get help. He seemed like he was freaking out a little bit. Like most people, you shook up. He's in trauma. He's in trauma. Now, I will say this because I'm trying to be objective here. You dig what I'm saying? And, you know, when he knocked on this woman's door, she freaked out and called 911. Understandable. She didn't know him. This is the middle of the night. Understandable. Understandable. But what happened after that is not goddamn understandable. Because, see, when the officers approached him, when law enforcement finally showed up, instead of trying to ascertain what the fuck was going on, they tasered him. And being a black man, you know, I guess the taser just wasn't enough, right? Because, hey, just like with Rodney King, what did Sergeant Stanley Coons say on the stand that made the white people in that jury cry, right? When he said that he was large, black, and muscular, and I was afraid. Isn't that what he said? You know, words to that effect, right? He was scared because this was a black man. So, you know, this is a brother, Jonathan Farrell, 24 years old. Cock motherfucking diesel, evidently, right? Obviously, he was in shape. You dig what I'm saying? And, you know, he was 24 years old. So he had all of his powers. You understand what I'm saying? And when these officers approached him, that was just too much. So they tasered him on sight, obviously, and then shot him, according to the autopsy report, 10 times. You don't shoot a motherfucking elephant 10 fucking times. 10 times. Unarmed. He had already been tasered. So what the fuck is all this goddamn training for? You know, these cats are walking around. I'm talking about police officers. I'm talking about professional fucking police officers, right? They're walking around with thousands of dollars, $500,000 worth of fucking equipment. Supposedly non-lethal equipment. And all of the hours of training, all of the class time, all of the practical time, and they still don't know how to deal with a single black man who is unarmed. They have to shoot him. They have to taser him. Now, I guess we're supposed to feel a little better because this particular officer is being charged with manslaughter, but so the fuck what? The cat that shot, you know, the officer that shot Oscar Grant in the back while he was laying face down on the ground, while he was standing over him, well, they charged him too, right? And we all know if he hadn't tried to vamp out, you know, they wouldn't have charged him at all. They just would have just swept it under the rug like they always did. But he tried to leave, so they put it on him, and he still didn't end up serving his full sentence. So you're going to tell me there's justice? He, you know, Oscar Grant left a widow. He left an orphan out here. Again, I'm going to say this again because I still get people, you know, black folks who think that they have some status that like to say, well, they weren't legally married. You know, fuck you. On behalf of these women and all of the sisters that are down with their goddamn men that stick by them, you know, fuck you. On behalf of all of those sisters, fuck you, okay? That's a widow. I don't give a goddamn if they have paper between them, you know. If you're in love with some goddamn buddy, you don't need a fucking marriage license. You need fresh linen. You dig what I'm saying? You know, if you're staying there and you're going through life with that person, you guys are going through the struggles together, you are sharing tears and what have you, you're sharing your aches and your pains and your fears and your anxieties and your dreams, don't fucking tell me they're not goddamn married. Don't fucking tell me that. See, that's that white man's theme. You want to fucking, oh, well, it's all legal. Well, shit, when they took our goddamn land, they made it legal here as native people. They took our fucking land, right? And it's all goddamn legal, right? We've been citizens since 1924, 26, whatever the fuck it is, to say, yeah, eminent domain. All of this shit is ours. I mean, 400-plus goddamn treaties have been signed with the government. How many have been honored? Don't tell me about fucking legal. You had the damn civil rights bill in, what, 1865? And then 1965, they did it again, which means what? That the first one didn't mean any goddamn thing. It didn't mean anything. I mean, there's a lot that we said about the late Khalid Muhammad. But, I mean, he was totally right about this. If you have to keep coming back to the goddamn law and keep asking for more laws, why don't you just accept the fact that they don't fucking want you here? You know, like you got WikiLeaks. You know, I mean, we can get into a whole goddamn thing about what WikiLeaks is about and all that kind of shit. But see, the thing is, though, they cut off all the payments from them through PayPal and all that kind of shit, right? But you can still donate money to the fucking Ku Klux Klan, though. No problem. The White Patriot Party, you can donate money to them. Turner, is he doing his podcast? Luke, is he still? Is he back doing what he used to do down there, right? Sean Hannity's friend, Hal Turner. The white supremacist. The white supremacist who ended up being a snitch, right? Ended up being a snitch. He ended up being an informant on the same people that he claimed to, you know, Sean Hannity's pal. You know, Fox News, Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity's friend, Hal Turner. Yeah, you can donate to David Duke. You can donate to Ron Paul. You can donate to any white supremacist out there you want to. But, you know, we're supposed to be told that, you know, this is the post-racial America, you know? This is post-racial. Every 28 hours. How many times does this have to happen before, you know, white people can say to themselves, we're doing this? It's just been released here by prison quotas. The Huffington Post. Not some commie website, right? Not some angry black man website. The Huffington Post. Says, yeah, you know, there's quotas for these prison populations, and if they don't put people in there, then the state has to pay the companies because of the contracts that they signed. Sounds like Alec, doesn't it? Sounds like a Koch brothers program, doesn't it? Sounds like the new motherfucking Jim Crow, doesn't it? But see, y'all are sleeping. You're more worried about what Beyonce's doing. Well, Beyonce's getting blonde, and she's bleaching her skin. She ain't thinking about you. And Jay-Z is saying that his presence is charity. He ain't thinking about you either. Because he believes that watching him get rich will inspire you to do the same thing. He ain't thinking about you. You know, and I'm going to say this too because this is how I feel. You know, I mean, people have been asking me, well, you know, the Roots, they've been working with Elvis Costello. And I'm like, so what? You know, to me, that now makes the Roots suspect. Why? Because a lot of you don't know this. Elvis Costello, they want to blame it on the alcohol, but he called Ray Charles. Ray Charles, who was no goddamn liberal, you know, he's no progressive. Ray Charles was not, you know, in any radical sense part of the liberation movement. Civil rights, maybe. Liberation, I'm not ready to give him that credit because I just don't see it in his record. I mean, he was like Lionel Hampton. I mean, he was always, you know, cool with the conservatives, right? But regardless of all of that, he's still a black man in the world, which means he's my brother. And as far as I'm concerned, Elvis Costello, of all goddamn people who should have known better, whether he was drinking or not, had no business calling Ray Charles a blind, ignorant nigger. Look it up. This isn't a conspiracy theory. The two white people he said it to reported it because they were offended by it. He called them a blind, ignorant nigger. So since I've learned that, oh, he also insulted James Brown, another person who was no radical. I mean, you know, he was Soul Brother number one, Geechee boy, you know what I'm saying, down with all of that, you know what I'm saying, Geechee man, down with my clan. But at the same time, living in America, right? He didn't say slavery in America. He said living in America. You dig what I'm saying? And he had no problem waving the flag and all that kind of, you know, thing. So, you know, no. he called him a nigger too, in the same conversation. So no, I have no, as somebody who used to like Elvis Costello, you know, sleeping with the detective, whatever, you know, I mean, hey man, you know, there was a time for that, and after I learned that, that was the end of it for me. Now, you know, a lot of these black folks who are really down with the roots and who love Questlove, especially since he's been on Democracy Now! Recently, they're telling me I need to chill out and reconfigure this and relook at it. And I'm just like, no. Because, see, the Reverend Jesse Jackson is still paying for Hymie Town. You feel me? Whether he really said that or not. Because the only reason we even know about that is because the black guy, the one black cat that was standing there, it wasn't even him that was in the middle of the conversation. He went and said something to a white reporter and made sure it got into the press. Now, he got to come up from that because nobody even knew who the hell he was before that. I specifically remember somebody saying, you know, two white guys talking to one another when that happened, saying, I thought he worked in the mailroom. Do you kind of understand? You know, let that trickle down for a second. Two white guys, as far as I know, who were not journalists, are speaking amongst themselves about the Hymie Town incident. And when it came to the black reporter, once he was finally identified, who is supposedly the, you know, the quote-unquote journalist, because nobody had ever heard of this cat before, right? And all of a sudden, he was one of their top journalists, right? They're like, yeah, I thought he worked in the mailroom. But like I said, he got to come up off that, and Jesse Jackson hasn't been forgiven since. So I don't see any reason why we should forgive these white folks for saying what the fuck they're saying. I mean, any black person that is feeling bad for Paula Deen is a fool. And you were probably one of the jerks that stood up and clapped for her when that case was dropped. You know? I mean, you're going to forgive her for this? Are you kidding me? That she shouldn't receive one black dollar. When you see her on television, you should turn the television off or turn to another goddamn station. Why are you supporting what no other group would support? I don't get this. But then I do get this. It's the Toby syndrome. You heard it here first. The Toby syndrome. Okay? They beat you and beat you and beat you. You say Kunta, they beat you and beat you in front of every goddamn buddy, especially your woman, so that she knows. They want her to know, man, psychologically, this nigga can't do a goddamn thing to protect you. He can't even protect his fucking self. Now look, I just broke this motherfucker. Your name is Toby. Kunta, your name is fucking Toby. Your name is Toby, motherfucker. You're Toby. And they keep beating us and kept beating us to the point now we say Toby. And if you don't understand that, hey, the white man doesn't have to call you a nigga anymore. He leaves it up to you. Matter of fact, you go on white television shows and demand the right to be called nigger. It's a human right to be called a nigger, right? You demand the fucking right now to insult your goddamn self. So, you know, hey, the damage has been done. The damage has been done. Black man and woman can't get your motherfucking act together because you don't know who the fuck you are. And then you get angry when somebody tells you that you don't know who the fuck you are because you think you got an iPhone now that you can somehow run with Beyonce. Listening to her and dyeing your goddamn hair blonde and shit and now fucking around with these goddamn skin bleaching creams is not going to bring you any motherfucking thing. It's not going to change your goddamn situation. You may think that something's happening when you look in the fucking mirror, but you look like a fucking fool. You don't realize it. Because white people keep saying, yeah, yeah, you look, I'm telling you as somebody who's tommed and fucking assimilated and who spends the majority of his goddamn time with white people, they think you're a fucking idiot. They're laughing at you every time you fucking turn your back to them. I'm telling you because I'm out there with these motherfuckers. All right? I'm out there with them. You know, you work with them. You know, you're on the bus or whatever with them. I'm in their fucking homes. I'm with them when they're drunk. And shit. You understand? I'm with them when they're high. And they really fucking say what the fuck they really think about us. Alright? I'm in these confines where these fuckers are honest enough to come out and say, these niggas look crazy. That's what they say about you. That's what they say about you. But, you know, you want to continue to move in. Now, it's like, you know, you see something like this. How many of you are complaining about Jonathan Ferrell? How many of you even know about Jonathan Ferrell? How many of you are going to say anything about fucking Jonathan Ferrell? Are you waiting for Oprah to say something? She ain't going to say a goddamn thing unless she thinks it's going to get her some ratings. And Obama's not going to say anything unless he's embarrassed. Because he didn't say anything about Trayvon Martin. If you think he said anything, you're an idiot. And when he went to the anniversary of the non-march, or we really need to call it the picnic on Washington, the civil rights picnic on Washington, because that's what Malcolm X identified it as, because that's what it was. All right, he still turned around and did the same thing he did in the great race speech of 2008. He blamed the conscious African people who are fighting against oppression, fighting against racism, fighting against marginalization, and for our sisters who are fighting against the racist misogyny that they have to deal with, he blamed us. He blamed us because, you know, we make white people mad because we're asking for too much. You know, treat me like a human being. Oh, wow, I'm asking you for way too goddamn much, right? I'm out of pocket, right? So, you know, if you're waiting for the talented 10th to come down and save you, it's not going to happen, brothers and sisters. It's going to happen. Jonathan Ferrell is not with us anymore because we did not stand up as a goddamn community. And I'm ashamed to say this, but it's the truth. We're not going to stand up for him either. We're not going to stand up for him either. We let what happened with Trayvon Martin happen, and now this happened. How about Frederick Carter, found hanging on a tree in Louisiana? What was done about that by the black community? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. But we'll argue for gays, though, to get into the military. We'll argue for gay marriage, but we will not argue for our own existence. You don't have a problem with that, then something's wrong with you, especially when I'm looking at a situation right now where you have a bunch of police officers that were convicted for shooting an entire group of goddamn people in New Orleans. I mean, they just took their time and had fun and basically, you know, shot down a group of people. Now, I'm reading this from CNN now. So you can't accuse me of going to some radical site to get this data. This is CNN. Now, I'm reading this from CNN. Now, this is the original post by the CNN wire staff when these guys were initially convicted. Now, they're saying that the shootings occurred on the Danziger Bridge on September 4th, 2005, 6 days after the New Orleans flood, you know, which happened during the Katrina hurricane. Now, prosecutors contend, I'm reading directly here now, prosecutors contend the officers opened fire on an unarmed family, killing 17-year-old Jason Brissett and wounding four others. Minutes later, one of the officers shot and killed Ronald Madison, a 40-year-old man described by justice officials as having severe mental disabilities. Madison was trying to flee the scene when he was shot, according to a Justice Department statement. One of the officers allegedly stomped and kicked Madison before he died, the statement noted. Now, they were all sentenced. They were all sentenced after this. Now, yesterday, the Associated Press reported that New Orleans cops did get a retrial in the fatal shootings following Hurricane Katrina. It turns out that their convictions were overturned. A U.S. district judge decided that, hey, you know, they didn't, you know, there was a carnival atmosphere, so they couldn't get a fair trial. So he just dropped everything. So they're going to get a retrial, which means what? They're going to walk. They're going to walk. And if you can rationally believe what's being reported, and this is the NY Daily News, it says here that the public must have absolute trust and confidence in this process. Retrying this case is a very small price to pay in order to protect the validity of the verdict in this case, the institutional integrity of this court, and the criminal system, and the criminal justice system as a whole. Now, this was less than a week after the Katrina tragedy. There was no need to do this. And Democracy Now! Reported on even more shootings that were done by people who lived in the area who were bragging about shooting people. White people who said that they were going to protect their neighborhood. And they were bragging. Democracy Now! Has the video of these people basically admitting what they were doing. One of them said that's how he got his wings, that he was a true Southerner now because he got one. But you still think that, you know, there's a future for the black man in the United States, right? You think there's a future for Africa, seeing everything that's going on. AIDS, AFRICOM, you know, what happened in Algeria, what happened in Tunis, what happened in Libya? No. Egypt right now? No. Right? all the chaos that's going on with Mugabe, they're disallowing him to just wreck everything, right? Then you got the hypocrisy when you go further south, right? And they say apartheid didn't die, right? And how are our brothers and sisters surviving in Brazil? Does anybody even talk about the African population of Brazil? Does anyone talk about the diaspora, period? Well, I mean, you know, it is what it is, and I'm supposed to, I guess, just deal with this, but I can't just deal with this, because this is wrong, this is inhuman, this is insane, and we need to really get up off our asses and start talking about the hell is real, because, I mean, how much longer are we going to continue like this before it turns out that we have, it's not that we don't even have anything, it's just that we're not even, we won't even be in a position to defend ourselves at all, in any way, shape, or form. And I'm not making an ethnic, xenophobic argument. I'm not talking about black supremacy. I'm talking about black fucking survival. There's a big goddamn difference. Understand the difference. And stick around, because I got an excellent interview coming up. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned. We're going to take a break so stations can identify themselves. This is Radio for Intelligent Aboriginals. Stick around.
Hey, this is Zesh9 from Zesh9.com, and you're listening to the Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All the yellow niggas, right? Look, man, I am tired of that. I am not passing. I am black. Do you hear me, man? You understand? I am black. I'm a nigga. You understand me? I was born black. I live black. And I'm gonna die probably because I'm black. Because some cracker that knows I'm black better than you, nigga, is probably gonna put a bullet in the back of my head.
Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The podcast for Intelligent Aboriginals.
Curious or confused, get information or a pamphlet at most pharmacies or a health clinic. If you need help, see a doctor.
My name is Nicholas Soames. I'm the Member of Parliament for Mid Sussex, and I am the grandson of Winston Churchill. I've decided to lend my strongest possible support to this campaign because I am appalled by the dishonesty and the disgraceful way in which the British National Party have used Churchill's name, particularly during the European election, where they used his face, his features, his words as promotional literature, trying to pretend that Churchill would have admired and supported the aims of the British National Party. What they have done is not only dishonest and irresponsible, but it's downright misleading to try and pretend that Churchill would have had any sympathy with the British National Party, whatever. He would, I can assure you, have laid everything that they stand for. Churchill led a national government. He was acutely conscious, as Britain's war leader, of the need to have a national government, to bring all parties together. And yet what the BNP seek to do is to divide all parties, to bring division and upset and lack of coherence to our communities by driving wedges between people. That is the exact opposite of everything that Churchill wanted to do in the national government. This is a peaceful country, and what they bring to it is uncertainty, fear and confusion. There is absolutely nothing that is British about the BNP.
Hi, I'm Buffy St. Marie. We have overcome many obstacles in our history as Aboriginal people. We've survived. Today, we must work together, become leaders in the fight to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS in our communities. We have to think about the 7 generations ahead of us. It's a matter of survival.
I Don't Know More calls all people
to join in peaceful revolution,
to honor Indigenous sovereignty,
and protect the land and water
for generations to come.
Mexicans, South Americans, all Indigenous people, get inspired,
take action,
and become a part of the solution.
It's my future,
your future,
our future.
We are the protectors of Mother Earth.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up
and protect our Earth.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
And become a part of this incredible movement.
The time has come.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Become idle no more.
You can't bring up, one guy sent me a very interesting thing about Barack Obama and race. You can't bring up anything other than that suddenly he's African American. If you start to, you know, delve around the edges of, wait a minute, isn't he mixed race? Weren't we told that last year? Whatever, biracial. Not allowed to say that anymore. Apparently, the mainstream media has dubbed him to be African-American.
Yeah, I was driving in today, and I was seeing, because I saw this the piece with him on 60 Minutes, and I thought to myself, he's very white in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, gee, can I even say that? Can I even say that without somebody else starting a campaign saying, what does he mean he's very white? He is. He's very white.
When a Muslim without a birth certificate has taken over the White House, you need a good white former junkie to show you the direction that America needs to go in. Beck, it's What's for Demagogue.
Voices Indigenous Radio brings to you the basics of how not to violate the law and presents the people who are fighting the war against Mother Earth. We bring the awareness of a different paradigm to the airwaves of WBAI as we shed the same old systematic paradigm that is killing Mother Earth. And you can hear the perspective of Indigenous peoples throughout the world and how they live with the law, land, air, and water. First Voices Indigenous Radio is produced in the studios of WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming and archived on WBAI.org and FirstVoicesIndigenousRadio.org.
This is FSN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my story from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at FSRN.org.
Hey, yo, what's up, y'all? This is DJ Spooky, that Subliminal Kid, giving y'all a wild style shout-out. You're rolling with a podcast that's licensed under the Creative Commons license. So I just want to say check it, download it, remix it, transform it. This is all about the wild style remix. So once again, Creative Commons, y'all, DJ Spooky, wild styles in your area, subliminal minded.
You are listening to the Angry Indian Non-Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting to the people of the fourth world from within occupied North America. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome back. We're speaking to Malachi Daniels. He is a writer, a poet, an illustrator, and a street activist. He is also an unorthodox Muslim. And he is an old school hip hopper and hardcore Fanonian dialectician with revolutionary love for the people. And, you know, for those of you who are not aware of Frantz Fanon, You really need to go back to the mailroom and, you know, start from square one and work your way up. Because that is pretty much the level of thought that we're going to be dealing with today, and it's entirely international. So, you know, we're really going to be dealing in diasporic concepts, ideas, and, you know, even though we're based right now in the occupied confines of occupied North America, what we're talking about affects every African around the planet. So I'd like to welcome Brother Malachi Daniels to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Thank you for having me on, brother. I know it's been a long time coming. We've been trying to get this together for a little bit. I'm glad to be on.
Yeah, finally. Yeah, thank you, man. It's an honor. So, you know, we've been talking about a few things, but one of the things that you mentioned last was, what is it about Africans that when we see each other, we avoid each other?
Hmm. And I definitely, there was a quotation that you pulled up in our Twitter discussion that I hope that you elaborate a little bit on later. But, you know, I guess our discussion happened a little while ago, just in terms of some of the degeneration that's happened. I mean, obviously, you know, we know that the condition of African people globally is one of, you know, as Fanon said, a deep inferiority complex. But we, you know, things never stay the same. Either they heal or they become malignant. And we're definitely at a stage in our particular colonized psychosis that where we are outright acting as the arm of our own oppression and white supremacy, which I'm encountering more and more in the streets of America.
Well, I mean, after what happened with Miley Cyrus and the controversy in terms of twerking and African dance and African sexuality and how the music industry, hip-hop in particular, or the rap game, however you want to look at it, looks at the and objectifies the African woman physically and totally dismisses her natural sexuality for something that really can only be defined as wantonness, you know. And then you have Miley Cyrus, Robin Thicke, and they do this grind thing. These are two white people who are using African isms, but they're surrounded by black and Latino people to make it all look legit. And before you give me your answer, I wanted to point out, if you go through our links, ang-newswire.blogspot.com or any of our other sites, you'll find that we have a link to a story that says that $70 million has been made off of not the song or anything, but the whole controversy behind the Miley Cyrus grind.
I did see that this morning.
You know, I mean, your opinion on all of this and where the African, especially the conscious African, fits into this milieu.
You know, it's very interesting. You know, probably for people like you and I, who we're not watching television, you know, and ingesting it the way probably the vast majority of people do, because it disgusts us so much. But you know, I've been watching the whole Miley Cyrus thing before this latest controversy, and it was very interesting. Obviously, you know, she's got they gave her street cred. The brothers in hip hop and black men, I guess, have taken to defending Miley Cyrus in the past. Am I correct on that?
I believe so.
and obviously she's, you know, she's gotten the support of Jay-Z and her twerking video. I guess the thing that had struck me at the whole performance at the MTV Awards, and it was absolutely disgusting, is how black women not just objectify in the Venus Hottentot sense, but, you know, but on stage sort of used as almost like circus freaks.
Yeah.
You know, if I can use that term.
I believe it's accurate, especially when you take into account that Africans have been used, and Filipinos, in human zoos at the World's Fairs. you know, Ota Benga is one name that comes to mind. He was known for having sharpened teeth. And I believe he passed away in captivity because he really didn't have much of a life. He was brought and used at the World's Fair. I mean, the United States has used human zoos. And yeah. It did cross my mind as I was watching Cyrus and Thicke go through their thing and looking at all of the brown people that were surrounding them to basically add white Negro legitimacy to what they were doing. Norman Mailer, I believe, would actually look at this and point this out.
Brother, it was actually like watching a live action Tarzan film.
Exactly. You know, it's like, where do you go with this? 2013, we've had a black president. I'm not going to call him an African president. He's a black president, all right? And he has not said anything about anything. You know, people talk about the great race speech of 2008, where he basically blamed people who were part of the not civil rights movement, but part of the liberation movement, for being excessive, for being angry. For realizing that their human rights were being violated, not simply their civil rights, but their human rights. And he recently did it again at the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights March on Washington. Where
he dismantled us and our beliefs in black liberation and blamed the liberation movement for spoiling the waters of America.
Yeah. And as one sister said to me, you know, she told me, she goes, look, I don't have a whole lot of itch, but I had enough common sense, though, when I read that Oprah Winfrey wasn't allowed to buy an alligator purse in Switzerland, that didn't have a damn thing to do with me.
yes, and exactly. And I'd like to second that, what that sister said. Oprah Winfrey experiencing it. I think once a decade, Oprah Winfrey gets reminded that she's a Negress. She goes shopping somewhere exclusive, and they remind her, you know, someone who can't recognize her outside of her costume, I guess.
Well, they didn't know who she was in Switzerland, and they weren't particularly interested. They probably figured that she was, you know, some African who had some money, who basically felt that she could walk into this shop. And I'm saying that from my own personal experience, because, you know, I'm going to say this. You know, one of the trips I took to New York as a young man, I walked into the original Tommy Hilfiger flagship store with the party I was with.
I see.
And they asked me to leave. And I'm going to say this too. The same thing happened in a Gap store. Now, this was back in the 80s. You understand?
Right.
And, you know, I was asked to leave. You know, even though I was with a group of white people. You know, I was asked to leave. So, you know, what happened to her can happen to any of us.
Right. And it does happen to us on a regular basis, daily.
You know, but what really, you know, irritates, you know, people who are of the conscious tip is the fact that she expected the black community in the United States and Africa, I suppose, to support her because this happened to her.
Right.
At the same time, the butler was being shown coast to coast.
Right.
Where we're told that the Black Panther Party for self-defense is really what held us back.
Exactly. And people don't understand how profound that is, that Barack Obama takes, you know, he takes almost every opportunity at a black function or a function that is, you know, is commemorating someone who we love and respect, or if he's giving a commencement address, to basically put us in our place. He takes every opportunity. And there's something else sticking in my mind. We were just talking about Ota Benga. And I just wanted people who will research Ota Benga to understand that Ota Benga did eventually commit suicide. There was a movement around freeing Ota Benga from the Central Park Zoo. This is the brother we were talking about earlier, who was held in captivity. And he did eventually get a job in the Midwest. He never did return home, and he did eventually commit suicide. And I didn't want to leave that out. I thought that was very important that we speak on that brother and what happened to him.
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely important to speak on him and all of the other human beings that were forced into these or coerced, if you want to take the you know, the white man's view of it, you know, the liberal view of it, into being, you know, exhibits in human zoos used at the World's Fairs. that were held in the United States. It seems, brother, in a lot of ways, we've gone into a very vicious circle where we're going exactly right back where the hell we started in terms of our connection to the Western world. But even then, and, you know, I want to, you know, ask you about this. You know, we will look at, say, Pushkin and not connect him to our history. We'll look at the pyramids and not connect that to our history. We'll look at the Olmec and not connect that to our history. We'll look at the Buddha and not connect that to our history.
Absolutely.
We're ashamed of Vodun. You know, and as a Geechee, I know many black people that do not talk to me to this day because I'm Geechee, right? You know, prejudice is, you know, like, oh, well, you know, you're the niggas that used to give us a hard time, the slave owners, right?
Right.
Right. So, you know, it's like, you know, when we look at the example of Obama, and, you know, I don't want to particularly, you know, put everything on Oprah Winfrey and Jay-Z and Beyonce, because I do bring them up quite often in this show. But, you know, the point is that the spotlight is on them right now. And, you know, they're not doing anything, you know, even within an objective sense, to speak to our true history, our liberation. And, you know, like I said, you know, one of the reasons, and I want to say this to the listeners, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to have this brother on is because a lot of the folks who consider themselves to be RGB, to consider themselves to be Afrocentric, you know, they want to blind you with their kente cloth and what have you. You know, when it really comes to, you know, identifying black and African, I don't think they understand what the hell that really means, you know, because they get caught up in skin and they get caught up in the anger of what's happened to us. And what I'm calling that is right now with this, I'm calling that the Toby syndrome to where, you know, you're just really mad with white folks because of what's happened, because you're suffering, but you can't really identify and articulate what's happened. And see, and that's in one way, you know, in one, you know, dynamic, you're safe because of that, because you're not trying to go any deeper.
Right.
See, yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like the brothers that will continue to listen to Farrakhan, even though knowing that Minister Farrakhan, with all due respect, is not quoting Alex Jones. He's not quoting Ron and Rand Paul.
Right.
People who are sitting around plotting our destruction. You dig what I'm saying?
I do.
And, you know, it's like, where is this mentality coming from? That, okay, well, because the Reverend Al Sharpton now has a spot. Well, the Reverend Al Sharpton now has a spot because the Reverend Al Sharpton has done what he's normally done throughout the decades. He has put himself into a position to make his own come up.
Absolutely. I mean, we're at the point where we can very clearly trace our history for the past 40 years. It's very clear that we share a great deal in common with the Africans on the continent, their particular position right now under a leadership of African, as our comrade would say, our comrade Barack on last would say, the African leadership class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had our leadership replaced. We had a revolutionary leadership. A leadership in some ways that was reformist, a revolutionary intelligentsia, a vanguard that was actually challenging every aspect of this society. And we had a black middle class that largely, although they were aware, were basically many of them in school, sitting back watching the movement. And many of them biding their time and watch people murdered, watch people assassinated, watch people in prison. Many, many political prisoners, our leadership are still in jail right now. Mm-hmm. And basically
in a country that doesn't even admit that it has political prisons.
No, not at all. Not at all. America has, you know, white North American political prisoners, obviously native indigenous folks who are still in prison, and, you know,
Marilyn Buck and Lynn Stewart, I want to mention in particular.
Right. Absolutely. We do constitute a colonized people. We had our leadership assassinated, and the American government replaced our leadership. I don't want to get off into conspiracy theory, but you look at people like Ron Karenga, who was directly involved in the murder of Panthers. Bunchy Carter. His organization his organization at the time, United Slaves, was very suspect, and can possibly be directly to the federal government. So that, you know, obviously those things happened over and over until you have 40 years of liberal democratic leadership that have led us nowhere. That haven't challenged anything. We're in a, as many people have said from the civil rights movement, that we're in a worse condition now than we were at the beginning of the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, when white analysts and reporters and journalists in the UK and France and Serbia can point that out, that's a problem.
Right. Absolutely.
That's a problem. I think it's embarrassing that you have to look at the international news, and even from places where they don't really have free news in terms of, and it's not to, you know, I'm just being objective here. Press TV, I think, is an excellent news service, but at the same time, it's a state-run and operated and concisioned news service. Same thing with Russia Today. You know, it's what they're putting out there as propaganda against the West, you know. In their own way, they're doing the same thing. They're all doing the same thing. But I think it's embarrassing as an indigenous person. I think it's embarrassing as an African in the United States that I can get more information on what's happening about, you know, our people. Not in terms of entertainment. Not in terms of who has got a new record coming out. Not in terms of who's got a new video or a new fashion line. I'm talking about in terms of human rights abuses towards the African and indigenous person in the United States, that you have to go to Al Jazeera, that you have to go to Press TV, that you have to go to The Guardian UK, you know, that you have to go to, you know, the French news services, that you have to read in Der Spiegel what's happening here.
Absolutely.
In terms of racial profiling, you know, every 28 hours and what have you. You know, I mean, we're going to take a break here in a moment, but, you know, you brought up Karenga and some, you know, basically dirty laundry, you know, in the African community.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, we can also, you know, really bring, if we really want to, you know, bring this up, the American Indian movement in terms of Ray Robinson Jr.
True.
Right. You know, what happened to him? You know, first he's with King, he's with, you know, the march and everything, and then he shows up with Wounded Knee, and then nobody ever sees or hears from him again.
Right, he's disappeared.
He just disappears, right? So, you know, a lot of folks who are like, well, you know, maybe that was a COINTELPRO thing. Hmm. You know, a lot of us are just like, look, you know, we've never talked about the racism in the Indian community against African people, and why we really shouldn't be against each other.
Hmm.
You know, because the other woman that's and where these cases are connected is Anna Mae Quash, you know, and her and Leonard Peltier are two Indians who went down. But Anna Mae Quash used to work with the African communities in the areas in which she was active. And here you had Leonard Peltier, who also worked with African communities, who was on record as saying that it was the Black Panther Party that gave the inspiration to the American Indian movement.
Absolutely.
And we look at how these two people went down. We're going to come back in a few minutes. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We're speaking with Malachi Daniels. He is a poet. He is an Afrocentric thinker. And we're hitting on some areas that I didn't think we were going to particularly run into. But we're going to take a break so stations may identify themselves. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Internet radio for smarter than original.
You got to conform to the society in which you live. You got to live within it or outside of it. You can't straddle a fence. Now, are you going to live outside of the American culture? Or are you going to live within it as long as you stay in America? You got to conform. What else can you do?
This is Cindy Sheehan. George Bush, Dick Cheney, and others launched a war that took my son's life. Strong evidence suggests that in promoting the war, they lied to Congress and the American people, and that in conducting the war, they have targeted civilians, hospitals, and journalists, used illegal weapons, imprisoned without charge, tortured, and spied on Americans without court approval. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Ask your Congress member to begin impeachment proceedings against George Bush and Dick Cheney.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Hello, I'm Carol Warden. The Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center asked for your help in spreading awareness of the National Public Awareness Campaign for the availability of Plan B within Indian Health Service. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that is routinely denied to Native women at IHS facilities. Although Plan B has been available without a prescription for adult women since 2006 and as of 2009 available to women age 17 and up, it is still not provided over-the-counter at 90% of IHS pharmacies. Our goal is to ensure that Plan B is available as an over-the-counter contraceptive for all Native women and to incorporate access to Plan B into standardized sexual assault policies within IHS. We also seek to inform Native women of their right to Plan B so that they are able to make informed decisions regarding their reproductive health. Please help us get the word out. Native women are entitled to the same level of health care as all other women. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
HIV संक्रमितहरूलाई माया, ममता र समाजमा सम्मानित जीवन जिउने वातावरण निर्माण गरौं।
यो उनीहरूको अपेक्षा होइन, अधिकार हो।
रोगलाई तिरस्कार र बहिष्कार गरौँ, रोगीलाई होइन। एचआईभी अरूलाई मात्र होइन, तपाईँलाई पनि लाग्न सक्छ।
सकारात्मक सोच, स्वस्थ समाज अनि सही निर्णय नै सरल तथा सफल जीवन हो।
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास।
Este es Radio Insurgente, voz del Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional, transmitiendo desde las montañas del sureste mexicano.
The podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Do yourself a favor. Get a mind transplant. Listen to independent radio, the alternative media in general. This is Ward Churchill saying have a nice day.
All right, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We're speaking with Malachi Daniels. He's a poet, he's a writer, he's an illustrator. But more importantly, at least for our purposes today, he is a street activist. He is an unorthodox Muslim. He is also an old-school hip-hop head and a hardcore Fanonian dialectician with revolutionary love for the people, meaning that he sees himself as an African in the world, which doesn't mean he's better, and also means that he's no damn less than you are. And he represents the areas of Harlem in New York City, and Washington, D.C., which, depending on who you ask and where you are and what particular mindset you're in, is the center of it all. You can also find some of his work on thestoicjournal.blogspot.com, and you can find him the way I did on Twitter, at Fanonian. So, we want to welcome back our ideological comrades, you know, and everybody else who takes the time to check this show out. you know, even though they're not particularly of the mindset that we're in, but they're coming here for some education. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. You know, we've been getting into some dark territory. We're talking about COINTELPRO and the effort to stop the African in the United States from being independent. And, you know, we need to point out here that this, the same thing has happened to the white left. The same thing has happened to the indigenous people here of this land that we have to acknowledge. The American Indian Movement is probably the most physical and most public face. But, the you know, when you say American Indian Movement, you can be talking about several different things. You can be talking about the American Indian Movement Incorporated, or you can be talking about American Indian Movement, in which you're talking about Sitting Bull was a member of the AIM lobby for the simple fact that he told white people what was up without apologies. You know, the idea of racial politics in the United States, with the confusion of having a president of, first off, African descent paternally, but his mother came from a family of slave owners. And in the great race speech of 2008, you know, if you listen to the liberal faction in the United States, he spoke so honestly about race when he talked about how white people are reasonable for being nervous when they're in the presence of blacks, and how the belching of anger, the belching of frustration that took place in the 60s and 70s and early parts of the 80s on the East Coast were really the result of black people who were ignorant and narrow-minded and unnecessarily angry at a system that oppresses them on a daily basis. And how he justified the racism of his grandmother because she raised him, and that she had a reasonable expectation of entitlement when dealing with non-whites. I mean, am I taking him out of context in this, brother?
Not from what I've read. And, you know, I think even when, oftentimes when Barack Obama is, you know, attempting to, you know, kind of illuminate, you know, the race situation in America, I find it very hard oftentimes to not be insulted. Obama is he's you know, I have to be honest, you know, I try very hard to be patient with the folks who voted for Barack Obama. I did not, and many people voted for him twice, which I find unbelievable at this point. For someone to have seen him proven himself to be the black face of imperialism in the first 4 years, and then go back and act as if it was some kind of anomaly and vote for him again.
Mm-hmm.
But as we were saying in the earlier segment, it doesn't seem as if Barack Obama has any problem whatsoever, you know, playing the condescending white president and blackface, you know, because he insults us, it seems, at every opportunity. But he doesn't surprise me, because I saw him coming in the door. I saw Barack Obama coming in the door, and I even have comrades who I couldn't believe it, you know. And these were the quote unquote, you know, I guess the RBG folks that you speak of, who I spoke to them after, and I actually did an interview with Amy Goodman right outside of my voting precinct on 143rd Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, and was proud to tell her that I did not vote for Barack Obama, and that I voted for Cynthia McKinney. But I have comrades who told me that they couldn't make that vote of principle. They felt that it was so monumental, you know, and that their families pressured them and all of these other things to vote for Barack Obama, even though they saw who was funding his campaign. They saw that he was I used to call him a soda salesman, because when I used to watch Barack Obama, he reminded me of the Coca-Cola and Pepsi commercials of the 80s. He seemed like a corporate product.
Well, he is a corporate product, because think about it. Let's just, you know, go back in the Wayback Machine here for a little bit. and try to imagine what would have happened if the John McCain and Sarah Palin ticket had made it. What would Africa look like right now? What would Syria look like right now? What would Iran look like right now? You know, the people who are in charge of things are in business to make money. As Bob Dole said, the business of America is business, paraphrasing Woodrow Wilson. The business of America is business. So if you have two wild cards, two people who cannot be trusted to say the right thing at the right time, you know, who can always be expected to say the wrong thing every time, there's no way that they were going to allow them to take over. So, you know, the business money, Goldman Sachs gave the majority of their donations, political donations, to the Obama campaign.
Well, they're smart. They're smart business people.
They were looking ahead because a black face could do what a white face could not do in Africa and Western Asia and South
Absolutely.
America, you know, Greater Asia for that matter, right? Because
Absolutely.
It would automatically have been seen as antagonistic to see a European face, especially a European face that has a history of saying, you know, ridiculously white supremacist comments.
Absolutely.
So, you know,
Steph,
he was the right package at the right time from a PR perspective.
You know, it's very interesting. I mean, it's, you know, I think on a personal level for African people, Barack Obama, if you know, those of us who are a bit more critical, we understand there's a certain, despite the overwhelming, hatred that African people receive throughout the world, there is this belief system that I think that with many people around the world that it's going to be us that's going to, you know, the most oppressed and the most maligned people, we're going to somehow eventually pull it together and we're going to help humanity out. And Barack Obama has squandered that. And he's done it happily so, I think. He has squandered our, if you people talk about political capital, he is our empathetic and human capital. He has squandered it. Because he's proven to the world, which, I mean, obviously those of us who are logical understand that Africans are capable of mass murder. But they now see that they're just like, they're just like everybody else now. And, black people can be imperialist as well. Although Obama is serving, he's serving a greater power than himself. He's he's a middle manager, like the rest of the middle managers here in America. But he's squandered that for us, and we've gone from an extreme where we had 40 years ago, we had we were coming to a place as a revolutionary family. In Asia, we came out of the Bandung Conference although we were losing our leaders, we did have a level of, it was an understanding amongst the oppressed people of the world that we were a revolutionary family and that we had to move towards liberating humanity. And now we're at the far end of the spectrum where we have a murderer, a black murderer in the White House. And it does seem like the darkest of times.
Well, see, that's a strong statement to say that. How would you explain that to the mainstream African in the United States, in Brazil, in Africa? You know, how would you explain, you know, that sort of a statement?
It's obviously, it's very difficult. I personally, brother, I just moved back to New York City, and I find one of the first things I've been doing, I'm very confrontational at times, but I like to think that I'm very confrontational with love in my heart. And so I do confront the white brothers and sisters who are part of the Occupy movement and who have moved into the black and Latino neighborhoods in New York City. And I'm very confrontational with them. I say, well, okay, you're here now. Are you going to help us with our problems? You know, and I recently did that on the A train here in New York City, and brother, it was very amazing to see all of the Black and Latino people attack me. They told me that I was harassing the white folks by confronting them about gentrification and racism and economic disparity and oppression and trying to get them to come to the table of humanity. And I had some Black people call the cops on me, brother, NYPD, kick me off the train. So it's very hard to speak to the average person. Very hard.
Oh, I don't even take that. You were just having conversation, right?
Oh, well, I mean, I was speaking to the people, and, you know, I've been trained to agitate and politically educate at the same time. I wasn't, by no means was I being meek in my presentation and in my questions, but I was definitely at the same time making sure that our white brothers and sisters understood that I recognized their humanity. But you have to do more for me when you move into my neighborhood and you drive and the merchants see you coming, and just because you're white, they raise the prices. Mm-hmm. You know, where a loaf of bread is now, you know, $5 just because they see the white folks coming.
Yeah.
You got to do more than smile at me. You know, I don't want to just see your smile in the morning, because that's not enough for me. I want to hear what you think about what's happening.
All right, well, see, you know, again, man, you're taking us into some, you know, some really dark corners, because we just saw, to kind of bring this around into terms of cultural media, mm-hmm. we just had Russell Simmons do the Harriet Tubman sex tape.
Yes.
And there are still people who are defending him in the African community. And I'm going to tell you, because like I said, I've never been, you know, shy about saying this. I'm what you know, or what is usually called as an assimilationist, I suppose. All right? I'm married to a Christian Palestinian. I've been with a lot of white folk. You know, I live around white people, have dealt mostly socially with white folks, you know, deal with all these different ethnic groups, step into the ethnic groups in which I actually have blood ties, what have you. I'm right. A cosmopolitan as can goddamn be. But I've never been confused, though, about who the hell I really am, because I always knew whether or not I was able to accept it at various points in my particular, you know, in my own life. You know, that's another story. But I can say right now at this particular point, you know, I accept the fact that I'm African and Native, and I don't apologize for that. And, you know, I come from where I come from. So, you know, when you're put into a position, I feel, let's say the situation you just broke down to us, you said the train. That's the public transit over there, right? So,
right.
You know, in situations where, well, I've been in Indian country, where, you know, someone called an African a monkey. Now, they weren't particularly referring to me, but they were referring to an African person. And when I called it out, you know, it had my Indianness being questioned, right? Or being in a black group and somebody said something about Jews that was not political, but just ignorant. And I'm not even going to, you know, call it racist, because it didn't have that kind of power. It was just bigotry, born of ignorance. Because basically they were believing what some white racist was saying about Jewish people. You dig what I'm saying?
I understand that.
You know, some kind of protocols of Zion nonsense, right? You know, so, you know, the kind of bullshit that Alice Jones pushes. And, you know, to call that out as what it is, to then be, well, you know, you're just saying that because, you know, you got Jew blood in you, and you're really a motherfucking kike, and you ain't really black, and, you know, and you're Native,
hey,
and you're Filipino, so I can't believe anything you say, you know. Right? So, you know, you're put into these positions by calling out, you know, legitimate communal grievances, legitimate ethnic hijinks, really. I don't know how else to put it.
Right.
You know, ethnic hijinks. What Robin Thicke and Miley Cyrus was doing to me was ethnic hijinks. And this is, you know, when I mentioned Norman Mailer earlier, he pointed this out in The White Negro. For those of you who are cognizant of the 60s modernists, or the mods in England. Rots quadrophenia, if you need a cultural reference, if you can't find the information. You know, what the original skinheads had grown out of in the UK. You know, these were white kids that were listening to black music because, you know, Jamaicans had started coming into England basically to clean their toilets. And were bringing the soul and blues albums with them that black American soldiers had left them in Jamaica. This is the history of this. That's how reggae got started. They didn't have anything there. It was, you know, black soldiers who had left their albums and what have you, that they started to pick this up. And backbeat and ska and eventually reggae was the result of this. And when they got to the UK, these white kids were basically white kids that were trying to be black. And then the working class political muckrakers over there in the UK started to realize in the British movement and the National Front, this is where the National Front came out of. They realized there's so many poor white kids that identified with this black music, so they went out of their way to re-identify it as white.
Interesting.
So hence you get the white racist skinhead, right? But when you look into the history of it, they come from ska, they come from rocksteady, they come from bluebeat, which is black music. And then you had Northern Soul, which was going on in Scotland and Nottingham and what have you, in Newcastle. So, you know, we have this history in the West of Europeans reconfiguring, re-identifying black idioms. I mean, Elvis Presley is the best possible example of this.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So what I want to ask you, brothers, is how is this clouding us when it comes to our political and social understanding, our theological understanding? Because we have the popular culture that has basically not just legitimized, but has mainstreamed the idea of the cool white Negro that takes his cues, but still has to stand on top of, in the pecking order, the black man, the Indian man, the South Asian man, right? Because we have a new Miss America that has South Asian origin, right? We have Bobby Jindal, real name Piyush, who says that he identified more with Bobby and the Brady Bunch than he did with his own people. You know, Nikki Haley, another South Asian, another Desi, who identifies more with white people than her own ethnic group.
Well, you know, it's powerful. It's I think just in the last 20 years, I don't know if you want, you know, to call it white supremacy reaffirming itself, because white supremacy never goes anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's entrenched itself in the psyche of young folks, and not even just young folks. I meet a great deal of folks who are my age and your age who can't seem to distinguish their own identity anymore, and seem to be offended that you even imply that they should have one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting to watch television, you know, and I see everything through the prism of, in many ways, of what's happened to many of the historical black communities on the East Coast, and I would say even in the West Coast, Central District of a Capitol Hill area of Seattle, which used to be a black neighborhood.
Oh yeah,
and
oh yeah.
I'm glad you're aware. You're aware of that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
A lot of us, I had to live in Seattle to find that out. I had no idea of our history in Seattle.
It's deep in Seattle, and the Black Panther Party had quite a presence in the city of Seattle.
Right.
Otherwise
right.
Known to my 5% brothers and sisters as Morocco. The Black Panther Party here had a hell of a presence. I'm still active on the communist comment sites and news sites.
Bruce Dixon?
Bruce Dixon. Is Seattle. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, you had a lot of heavy labor activity that went on in Seattle in the 1920s, 1930s, 1950s, 1970s. And the fact that it's been gentrified the past 20, 25 years, even where I'm at right now in Portland, you know, it's been gentrified. When I first came to Portlandia, you could see the mountains from downtown. Can't anymore. You know, there's a whole lot of new development. There, you know, it's crowded now. There's a lot of people here. So, you know, this does a lot happening. And, you know, where does the African fit into this?
Well, I want to bring it back around to your original question. You know, one of the things I experienced in Seattle, and I lived in the downtown area. You know, I shared a house with some good liberal white folks that I met who also considered themselves to be punk. Which I guess is why they allowed me to live with them.
Okay.
Although they did admit to me later after I moved in, when they thought when I first moved in that I might be a, they had a concern. We all laughed about it and had some wine. But the history of that, the central area of Seattle, which you go to Seattle now and it's been cleansed of black people.
Mm-hmm.
It's been cleansed of black people, and you have a white liberal, not always affluent, community that is there that really largely thinks of themselves as not being participants in a structure that oppresses and makes invisible African and Native people. And I mentioned Native folks there because one of the first things that I noticed in Seattle, and you go down to the waterfront,
mm-hmm.
at the totem pole, you see all the old indigenous brothers and sisters sitting there with the old black folks, and they all drink and get high together at the old totem pole.
Mm-hmm. And one of those brothers I have to mention was John T. Williams. He was the Native man, the carver, who was shot walking away from a police officer.
I didn't know that.
And the police chief resigned pretty much because of the FBI investigation that came down because of that. I mean, depending on who you read, if the local paper up there, The Stranger, has reported or quoted anyway, that the Seattle Police Department is supposedly way worse now, at this time, right now, than the LAPD.
I can believe that.
Which is saying something. You know, I mean, there are videos of a woman who was like 15-year-old young African woman who was punched out in her cell by two officers. And you had the Christopher Monfort controversy that went down over there. And I can't even get any information about that case. He had a personal beef with the SPD. And went all out and what have you, kind of like the way Donna was doing down in California. You know, because a lot of people forget about that case too.
Right.
You know, nobody even wants to talk about that anymore. And this is another tacky sheet, but I'm going to go on a tangent right now, because a lot of RGB people were out there pumping that Donna story. And I'm like, why are you looking up to this man? You don't even know why he's going crazy. You know, to me, he seems like an Uncle Tom that was going out for self.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was interesting, obviously, what Dorner was saying about the LAPD. But obviously, Dorner was a man who had no politics, was, you know, obviously had been to the military. You know, he supports the military and police complex. So,
exactly.
You know, that wasn't lost on me.
Exactly. So, you know, it seemed to me that he was pissed because he had a personal beef with them because he didn't like how he was treated. Because, you know, like a lot of Uncle Toms, and like I said, I cop on to this. I tom for years. I tom for decades. I tom before most of these listeners were born. And I'm telling you, I've been on both sides of the gate. And, you know, you hear a lot of things and you just ignore it, man, because you're trying to fit in. You're trying to be a part of the system because you don't want to be outside. You want to live your life. You want to do things, you know. And I never saw myself as a nigger. I never saw myself as a nigger. You know, so I'm saying I always wanted to do better or you know, the way the system has laid things out than what the hell I had in front of me. I was always wanted to make a come up. And you make a lot of sacrifices. And in my case, you get to the point where you just can't do that anymore. And you basically end up cleaning toilets for the rest of your life.
Right. You know, very, very similar to Randall Robinson, who used to be the president of Trans Africa, and who I guess initially, one of his the notoriety that he received when he wrote his book The Debt, what African Americans and what America, you know, owes and so forth. But he did write a book called Leaving America. And I believe he moved his family to Central America. And upon him being interviewed, he said, I got tired of accommodating the indignities in America. He got tired. So I thought that tied in nicely to what you were talking about with your own personal experience.
Well, I believe a lot of us, you know, anytime I've met any sort of position where, you know, I'm meeting up with a brother, be him African, be him Native, be him Asian, and on occasion, you know, Jewish, people who have been honest with me anyway, when they had to, you know, really admit to how people treated them when they found out that they were Semitic, you know, it's always the same thing. I had to, you know, pretend that I didn't hear what I heard. I had to walk away from a lot of, you know, insults. Just had to absorb a lot of, you know, bullshit. And then you get that title that I used to carry with a certain amount of pride that I was okay.
I see.
You know, you can say these things in front of him. You can, you know, whatever. He's not one of them. He's on our side. And see,
right.
And what I want, you know, is the black men that are in those positions to stand up and be honest about that. That you got that Porsche, or you got that cushy job, or you're living in that condo, or you were able to buy that house in that particular cul-de-sac because of somewhere down the line you kissed ass. And see, and the only black man that I'm aware of that's on the record of ever saying, you know, talking about the realities of that shit is Sammy Davis Jr.
Interesting. Sammy, huh?
Sammy. He made a movie called A Man Called Adam. Look that up. Cultural reference. A Man Called Adam. You're going to see a lot of people in there that you recognize. If you know anything about films and you know anything about the 60s and what have you, especially for you motherfuckers that are into the Rat Pack and all that, watch that film. He played a trumpeter who could not handle it. Nobody wanted to deal with him. Right? Because he was just too black. He wore the suit. He played for folks. He had no problem. And you know, he had his share of white women, but he always knew what the score was. He was Dick Gregory with an attitude, put it that way.
I see.
And then he met Cicely Tyson and Ossie Davis. And then, you know, she was Ossie Davis's niece in the film. And she basically broke him. She got him to calm down. And again, talking about the Rat Pack, the chairman's son was the white dude who joined his band.
Oh, really?
Sinatra's son, his son, Junior, is in the movie. And he plays the white cat who wants to join his band. And she's like, look, give him a chance. He says he's white. She says, so what? He's white. He's okay. Give him a chance. Matter of fact, Satchmo is in this too.
Really?
You got to see this film, man. And what it is, they all were like, you know, dealing with this cat who was still so angry with the world, with everybody. He was hurting himself. You dig what I'm saying? And then here comes Cicely Tyson, who shows him love. She says, look, I understand that you're angry. And she's like, you know, you can't push me away because I see you, black man. Because she was, people were hassling her because they looked at her as somebody who was down in the South carrying a picket sign. You know, she was one of those sisters that was in the movement, right?
Right.
Right. Homeboy was too angry to be in the movement. He was just angry. He was angry with the Toms. He was angry with white people. You know what I'm saying? He couldn't cope. So she came to him and gave him some love and basically, you know, said to him, look, I can accept your anger, but I can't accept you just, you know, spitting the, you know, the shit all over the goddamn place. Put it in the music if you need to. Centralize it. But, you know, you need to get centered.
It's when, you know, consciousness is a burden, isn't it? I guess we all experience that to a degree, and I can admit myself to you know, seeing some of the conditions of, you know, of what we're talking about, the cleansing of black people in American cities, not just in, you know, in neighborhoods and so on and so forth, but you know, obviously in terms of our art, you know, we speak about, you know, not to bring up people like Jay-Z and Oprah again, but what they represent in many ways is breaking of black consciousness, you know, the holding the fire to the status quo and to white supremacy, and that kind of was always a part of black artistic expression. And surprisingly enough, a show like The Cosby Show, and I never really liked The Cosby Show as a younger guy, but I look at it now and I go, my God, in comparison to some of the coonery that's on television now, my God, it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's embarrassing from a political standpoint, isn't it?
Exactly. I'm like, oh my God, I'm finding positives in The Cosby Show, and I was dead set against that back then.
Right. The women got married. Right. The men came home, represented themselves to the parents. Right. You know. You went to school. Mm-hmm. You were accountable. You came home at a certain time. It's just certain things that we take for granted that keep you in. But that's not the whole thing. They also were kept busy. And they had role models of which that they were worthy of looking up to. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up around pimps and players and dope slingers and what have you. And, you know, every now and again, somebody who had a solid blue-collar job.
I can identify.
You know, and this is where things are different to me, because when I was out there, those pimps used to tell me, they said, look, man, you know, if I ever see you trying to do what I'm doing, I'm going to stomp you down. And I'm going to tell your daddy that I stomped you down. This ain't for you. Go to school. Right?
All right.
You know, all those cats that were dealing with them, yeah, we used to look at the ladies and everything. Man, you know, we sit there and what have you. But it's like they say, hey, this ain't for you. Go the fuck to school. And, you know, cats that used to play hooky and what have you, they used to get a talking to by these men.
It's true.
You don't see that anymore. You know, see, their whole thing was, I'm doing this because I don't have another choice. I came out of the South. I have no education. This is what I'm stuck with. You have a chance to go to school. And this is, again, where I'm bringing back Sammy Davis. You know, I'm not going to give the whole thing of the movie, because you really need to watch it and see everybody that's in it. And you're going to see some people, like I said, you're going to be surprised that you see who's in it. But they were down with that project. The black folks, the white folks that were in that film were down with that project. They were trying to make a statement.
Right.
And, you know, what's going on. Now, anything Ossie Davis is in and Sissy Tyson, you know, has got something to it. And
well, it also brings up that particular generation of black artists, and Harry Belafonte was a part of that generation.
Mm-hmm. That's why happened between him and Jay-Z really bothered me, because I said, you know, Harry Belafonte was down with a movement. You're basically saying, watching me get rich and watching my wife get, you know, lighter and lighter as the years go by, as the months go by, you know. And it's not a diss. I'm just saying, how the hell are we supposed to say that she's the flower of black womanhood when she doesn't even look black any goddamn more?
Exactly.
And she's shucked and jived for every president that's been elected. You dig what I'm saying? She was up there with Bush and what have you, when what was happening to the people? No criticism. And she's still dancing for him.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm just saying, I have no problem saying to anybody that I believe Jay-Z, he's a person who is he's fascinated with white male power. So he attempts to emulate it. And some of the RBG brothers and comrades, I know some of them personally. And what I, you know, it's very interesting. I've seen over the years some of them make excuses. Because I, you know, mm-hmm. like many of us, man, we all have a sore spot for hip hop. But I agree with some of the things that you say and the damage that's been done. And a lot of the damage has been done by people being very liberal. You know, I remember confronting certain artists here in New York, and I said, well, you know, why don't you speak more so to the folks who are unprincipled and who are pushing this garbage on our people? And a lot of times, man, these very political and revolutionary artists, and I love these brothers, they would say certain things like, they say, well, you know, we're all in this struggle together, and these brothers coming out of the South or New York or whatever that maybe be spitting this ignorant stuff, it's a hustle, and nobody else is feeding them. The system is not feeding them, so this is how they get to feed themselves. And so these are the excuses that you hear.
Yeah, and you know, and like, you know, somebody about a month ago confronted me, you know, while I was getting coffee, saying, well, how come you don't get on Snoop Dogg the way you do, you know, Jay-Z and what have you? I said, because Snoop Dogg never at any time said he represented anybody but Snoop Dogg. You know, I mean, he's one of the smarter ones out of that entire milieu. I mean, he's moved on the Snoop line because he knows that there's no future in what they're doing. And he's made crossover, you know, I mean, he's much more realistic. And he said, hey, I don't speak for nobody. I'm not about nothing other than me. And I'm out here to get paid. And I respect him for being honest. Whereas Jay-Z and Obama, I mean, not so much Obama, well, him too, of course, but, you know, Oprah and what have you, they claim to be representing all of us.
It's true.
And that's what I don't appreciate. See, you know, I don't like that because I'm not nowhere near on the same program you're on, especially after you're going to push a film like The Butler. No, there's no way you can say you speak for me.
You know, it's, you know, and again, going back to your original question, it's, there's something else that is more deep and profound that is happening to African people. And you know what, brother, I've come to the realization lately that our silence as African people around what has happened to indigenous people, that it is sort of right some of the things that are happening to us, because we, you know, I saw one black news site, I think it was The Griot, or somewhere, that was celebrating the first black female fighter pilot, who's I guess she's on a campaign in Afghanistan or somewhere right now, and I that kind of attitude of celebrating and bolstering white power, you know, is disgusting, and we've done that for decades, if not more. We played a part in every military campaign that America has sought to have.
Every single conflict this country has been involved in, rightly or wrongly, the African and the Native has been involved. And that's not even talking about Crispus Attucks.
Exactly. You know, I remember walking through Harlem once, and I walked through Columbia University's campus. And, you know, to actually speak to my own colonial mind state, I guess just walking through the campus made me feel a little bit, you know, more intelligent. I happened to walk past a room where they were holding a lecture. There were various faculty were sitting in there, and I don't remember what they were discussing, but the room that they were sitting in, very nice room, had all African paintings on the walls. And there was not one African faculty member or staff member sitting inside this room. And it became very apparent to me that that was the intended future of black people in America, that we would, in a sense, become museum pieces as our indigenous brothers and sisters have been made to be.
Yeah, it's coming. I mean, it's hard to find fault with that, because you have, I mean, you know, a lot of folks are like, oh, well, you can't think that, you know, Obama would be against black people. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, look at South Africa. They're like, what about South Africa? Everybody's free. I'm like, everybody's free. Who still has what?
Right.
And I respect, you know, Brother Mandela. But, you know, what happened? What sort of deal was made before he was released? You know, Anglo-Americans still, they never lost anything. You know, the upper class never lost anything. Now, the white Boers, they lost, because the white British upper classes used them as the buffer between themselves and the oppressed. And I'm saying that because a lot of, you know, people, especially in the United States, are not particularly aware of the fact that you not just had the indigenous black population, but they were split up amongst themselves in terms of tribalism. And then you had Malays that were imported and what have you. You know, people don't even realize in the United States that the education here is so bad that the British government, the British Crown, went to war against the Boers to take over South Africa. They're not even aware of this. You know, and it leads into the politics there.
Right. Well, it's very interesting. I mean, South Africa, it appears, I think it appears to many people, but it appears to me that that the Boers that are left there, the whites who still do hold a certain amount of wealth there, tend to be biding their time. They seem to be observing the political scene like a chess master waiting for the factionalized indigenous population to implode so that they can basically move into power again.
Yeah, but that's not likely to happen, though. I mean, Europeans are always going to be outnumbered in Africa. Unless, and this is where we start to go into, again, darker levels. When we start talking about HIV, AIDS, Ebola, and, you know, how these particular hantavirus and what have you, you know, how these particular slate wipers, some people on the far right have called them, you know, these plagues that will come around to reduce. You know, I'm talking about, you know, the Ragnar Redbeard nonsense. That far right conspiracy nonsense that, you know, AIDS was, you know, it is a necessary thing and all of these other diseases to pretty much wipe Africa and Asia and the Americas of what they consider to be the impure peoples.
Right.
You know, and that's one thing that we can talk about briefly, you know, because we were mentioning COINTELPRO a little bit. You know, Darfar Perry is one of the names I had asked you about during the break, who admitted to his complicity, his being basically an inside man, an agent provocateur within the African community during the 1970s. There's a lot of talk about HIV and AIDS, and I believe today is acknowledgement in the African community in the United States for HIV and AIDS. There's a particular program going on. I just heard about it just yesterday, so I can't really speak on it. But what are your views on that? And how I'm going to set this up is this. You've had people who have been having, or human beings anyway, they've been having anal sex and trading blood and what have you for thousands of years. And not to say that there are not blood-borne illnesses and pathogens, but how do you explain this at the same time the World Health Organization is passing out work in Central Africa? And then we have the Kaprosky theory, for those of you who have read the book The River by, I believe his name is Tom Hooper, that suggests that it was either an accident or it was done on purpose, or the initial incident was maybe an accident, that HIV was created in the Congo, the Belgian Congo, where Hilary Kaprosky, now I'm not accusing him of anything, I'm just saying that his name came up for good reason. He was working in the Belgian Congo on the polio vaccine, and that he was using monkeys that he should not have been using, and that a virus developed and was actually recognized by Dr. Jonas Salk, who in correspondence with Kaprosky said that, you know, you're about to use something that, I mean, that has potential serious side effects, that we don't know how this is going to affect the host, meaning the person that this is going to be injected into, and that he said that he wasn't going to stop working, basically, because, you know, he wanted to continue. And, you know, we have to understand that the Belgian Congo, the Belgians, gave him full use of the African people in the town. And there's a documentary that has been shown on the BBC and the CBC, and I know I'm going on, I'm being long-winded about this, but, you know, brother, I see you as being a rational, conscious black man. What's the possibility of that?
Well, it's interesting. You know, my foster brother, who I was pretty close with, died of AIDS. And before his passing, I had gotten involved with, through political activism, going to different conferences on AIDS and treating it, and also, you know, dealing in the holistic health community. And so I was trying to, you know, help him with his health. And in doing that, I came across a great deal of studies myself. I don't know if, you know, but mostly from the holistic and health standpoint, there was a woman by the name of Dr. Clark who wrote a book, teaching people how to repair their immune systems, not only from AIDS, but from cancer and other various illnesses. And one of the things that struck me that she said in her study, she did an independent study where her and another colleague went to a couple of African companies, countries that had a high AIDS population, HIV/AIDS population, and found that in their drinking water, because what she had found was that benzene, the petroleum product benzene, was causing adverse effects on everybody, not just those with compromised immune systems. But what it was actually perpetuating or creating a situation where those people would be ripe to basically contract HIV/AIDS. What she found in the water supply was that benzene was a heavy product in the water supply in several African countries. So some of the things that you speak of in terms of the deliberate spreading of HIV/AIDS, I've read some of those documents. I've even talked to activists who have been trying to bring this information to the public for some time. So, you know, and there are countless, not even just with HIV/AIDS, there are countless stories of pharmaceutical companies been basically given free rein in certain African countries to experiment, to release untested virus and bacteria into the environment. So what you're saying is not far-fetched at all.
You know, I mean, you have to wonder because, you know, okay, let's do some really quick math right now. I don't have the information in front of me, but I'm just going to try to run through this pretty quick. You know, if you take into account the amount of human beings that were removed by both Arabs and Europeans during the slave trade, and then you take into account the fact of the, like what Germany did in East Africa, taking into account with the Belgians, the French, the British, you know, the United States came in pretty late. And then you have World War II being fought in North Africa and what have you. So you have all of these losses in terms of, you know, African life, in terms of not being able to regenerate. Now, like I said, I don't want to quote anything because I don't have the numbers in front of me. But the numbers are really serious in terms of really being conscious of the fact that since the slave trade, and like I said, I'm including the Arab involvement in this as well, because they got into it before the Europeans did. When you look at that, and then when you take into account AIDS, Africans have never been able to regenerate since that period. Our numbers have never grown.
You know, you want to talk about these things, and obviously, you know, people tend to make you feel self-conscious when you start talking about organized white supremacy and efforts to lower the African and Asian population. And obviously, you hear a great deal of things about the Gates Foundation, which I've seen documents that lean more towards the, the scientific and statistical to the more the conspiratorial thing. But it's very clear that, especially when you look at a place like Haiti, look at what's happened to Haiti. Haiti alone, Haiti, pretty much before some of the most recent incidents that we know of, was pretty much one of the first African nations to pretty much be decimated by HIV/AIDS. How did that leap happen? Supposedly, if it did initiate itself on the continent, as you know they like to popularly say, how was it initiated in such sense in Haiti, where it pretty much decimated? You know, it caused such damage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you talk to the folks in the quote unquote conspiratorial community, and you know, they say that there are documents to show that, you know, this, you know, Haiti was one of the first targets of this disorder, immune disorder.
Well, you know, one of the things that actually convinced me, not that HIV doesn't exist, but that there's something, you know, queer about the way that they're explaining everything, was reading the New York Times, page 1. where they found men of pure, and I'm quoting now, pure European, Northern European stock who were immune to HIV infection. And Wired.com has also reported on two women in Central Asia who were found to be immune from HIV infection. And it turns out that there's quite a few people like this running about in Europe.
Interesting. Very interesting. I hadn't heard that.
Well, you have to look for it. I mean, it's not out there. And again, it's not conspiracy theories. Reading the European press.
Right.
You
exactly.
Know, using these translators to read the European press. And you'll see this. And, you know, it's not something that, you know, people necessarily want to get around. But see, but then again, you know, this is where we get confused. And because you got the memes and you got people that got their own agendas. You got a documentary right now running about called House of Numbers. I don't know if you heard of it, but basically it's saying that HIV doesn't exist, that it's a whole schadenfreude to make the pharmaceutical companies rich, which, of course, you know, like I said, this is where Alex Jones, you know, where people get confused with him. He'll take a truth, he'll take a verifiable fact, and then run with it. And, you know, pretty much people who have an agenda, for whatever reason, you know, we can speculate about why that reason is, on why they would not want people to check themselves out and what have you. To say, I mean, they had Minister Farrakhan, they had the man who actually had the patent on the virus, which is another issue, right? You know, who owns the patent on this? Is it the Frenchman?
Right.
Is it the American? You know, it's like they take the confusion around this to push another political agenda, which is really benefiting whom? You know, I will never make the argument that it doesn't exist. I don't even know. But I know it's not what they're telling us for sure. You know, there's a lot of variables with this that really don't make any goddamn sense. And then you really have to ask yourselves, who's being affected by this and who isn't?
Well, those were one of the things that I did find in reading about HIV/AIDS. Obviously, the first people to patent the test for HIV/AIDS, and finding out that with the test itself, you're more likely to receive a false positive when you take the test that's administered now in the hospitals.
Well, see, I understand that the Western blot, and again, this is coming from, I believe it was actually produced in New York. I can't remember the name of it, but it was a pretty radical gay newspaper that said that Mediterranean and African men who go in for testing with the Western blot, which I don't know if they still use that, with the Western blot exam, will almost always come up positive because, you know, that the test is designed for Europeans.
Hmm.
Or was designed for Europeans. Like I said, I'm just throwing that out there. I don't say that it has any veracity.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that I did want to touch on, there was a paper that I came across maybe about 2 years ago. And someone had compiled, and when you talk about controlling the African population on the continent, there's evidence to show that the African population, there's been concerted effort to control the African population globally, especially here in America. I mean, obviously, you know, there's the obvious. There's the obvious of our poor health situation, which is the result of a myriad of things. But someone had compiled a paper with the numbers showing how basically there's a concerted effort to lower the population of Africans in America, and showing how it had happened and that what we're seeing right now, and it's sort of a silent genocide. It's not just obviously the police murders every 28 hours, but between our health situation, between you know, situations of death by cop. I don't know if you remember the brother who was murdered by firing squad in Times Square last year.
Mm-hmm.
There was a video of a young man who basically in the subways of New York laid down on the third rail of in the transit system and electrocuted himself. The psychological breakdown. What we're witnessing is psychological breakdown of Africans, you know, in a sort of mass suicidal mania that is taking place. That, you know, it is I think we are finally realizing, and I think a lot of people are realizing, that there's no real future here in America of equity and of dignity for the African. And so you have a myriad of health issues, along with the concerted efforts of government, that has created a slow genocide, in essence. And we're witnessing it. We're standing in the middle of it, while we're being entertained at the same time. You can tell me if I'm wrong, if you're seeing this or not, brother.
No, it seems to be what you say it is. I mean, you take into account that there's been study after study that have been reported by, because I know a lot of folks like, oh, you only quote the liberal, quote-unquote, sites. Well, you can call them liberal if you want to. I don't see them being all that goddamn liberal. Progressive, perhaps. But, yeah, Alternate, Truthout, and what have you, yeah, they will report the studies that the mainstream press would just notice but not really push out there, that, when it comes to Africans getting, adequate care in hospitals across the country, it's not happening. You know, no. Your private doctor is really not all that concerned about whether or not you get well. I mean, you're lucky if you get one that gives a damn about you. But if you're black, you know, you're not likely to get care. If you're Latino, which I hate to use that term Latino, but if you're an Indian who speaks Spanish from south of the Rio Grande, you're half as likely to get care as the same level of care as a white person. And if you're Indian, they're likely to tell you that you're drunk and to go home. that's the reality. We have a lot of sisters who have issues that could have been dealt with if they have received adequate health care the first time they asked for help, and they just simply looked at them and said, you're probably drunk, go back to your trailer and sleep it off. Women who have had their appendix burst,
right?
You dig what I'm saying? Because the attitude is, if an Indian comes in for help, they're probably just drunk. You know, I mean, there was a case, wasn't it in New York, where a woman was in a hospital and died on the in the waiting room?
There was an incident, I recall that.
And, because I remember seeing it, because it was on, the mainstream news, took a look at that, even though nothing happened about that. There was no real discussion about that. There was no discussion about how, basically, you can have the entire hospital staff and a security guard realize that this woman is on the floor and not help her.
Right.
You know, so
there have been incidents of people in, I'm sure not just New York City, but where people have died in the emergency room, and they'll sit there all day. A dead body has sat there all day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and speaking for someone personally who does not have health coverage, I've been to the emergency room and have to deal with those attitudes of doctors who clearly don't want you there. They don't want to treat you. Are very dismissive of regardless of if you're able to articulate what you're experiencing or not. They don't want you there.
Yeah, but here's the other controversy, because if you try to heal yourself, if you try to grow your own vegetables, if you try to, heal your own being, then they come down on you.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. We see that a lot on the West Coast, probably where you are, in the raw milk movement.
Yeah, raw milk, raw eggs, and what have you. You have a lot of farmers out here who are trying to grow livestock without using chemicals, and it just seems they got to jump through a lot of hoops, to do this. So yeah, man, it's a final question. Where do you see things going? Where do you think is going to happen here, especially, with 2000, the end of 2013 here, we're looking at it. How do you think things are going to wrap up?
There appears to be, obviously we're looking at this political theater around the debt ceiling, and obviously there always seems to be the rumor of some breakdown that will lead to some form of martial law and civil upheaval that will be manipulated by the powers that be. There's always seems to be that kind of thing always seems to be in the air. But I tell you, it's just speaking specifically about our people, you know, an African and indigenous people, and what I was touching on before about the kind of the I guess the breakdown of us, you know, psychologically and emotionally. I think that has a lot to do with us anesthetizing ourselves with reality television and artists, you know, like Jay-Z, who clearly don't give a damn about us. And the people are anesthetizing themselves, and it's very disturbing to see it. You know, I've gotten to a point where I feel like it's, you know, as I've seen a comrade do, and I was speaking about this earlier, of making excuses for the folks who indulge in things who they know are terrible for them. You know, it's you know, television and mass media has become like it's some form of a heroin, and the people are fully ingesting it, you know, in heat pools. And I've gotten to the point where I think those of us, you know, who are politically active need to stop making excuses for the people. I'm not saying you got to come at the people like Bill Cosby, but I think you have to. I think there's a level. People like Farrakhan have a popularity, man, because the people know that they require discipline. People know that things are wrong, and a lot of times people know that they got a sickness and an imbalance in them at times that causes them to hurt themselves or not do what's best for them. And I think, man, as those of us who are politically engaged and active, I think we need to, sort of like the religious people put forth a new version of human beings, and also don't make excuses for them, man. You know, don't make excuses for people who love ignorance.
Well, I'm gonna have to extend this just a little bit because you mentioned Bill Cosby and Minister Farrakhan. Now,
right.
I agree with you. One of the things that Minister Farrakhan has in his pocket when it comes to dealing with the African community is he understands how we need to be spoken to.
Right.
The problem I have is he's not Malcolm X.
Oh, agreed. Agreed. So I was just using Farrakhan as an example of someone who exactly knows how to speak to black people.
But yeah, his, you know, a lot of his policies, I'm saying if for somebody who has read The Son of Man, this hookup with Scientology doesn't make any sense to me.
I'm absolutely frightened by that, brother. We have two Scientology offices that have opened in Harlem in the past 4 years.
Are you serious?
Very serious. And I've approached them. I've approached the Scientology people. And ask them why they're in Harlem. And they always invite me back and say, okay, well, we need to sit down and discuss this a little bit further. They don't, you know, they don't want to speak directly to the issue, but something is going on. It's interesting. The Scientologists are in Harlem now, and also the Rosicrucian have opened up a storefront in Harlem.
See, man, you're just going too deep, further than I was prepared to deal with you today, man. The Rosicrucians, okay. Oh, so I got to ask then. So what are the 5% brothers doing with the Scientologists moving in the neighborhood?
You know, it's very interesting, brother. To speak very honestly on the energy of Harlem and New York City in general, it's been very disturbing. I've actually been working on a piece that I'm finishing off, a poem. And basically, I've titled it "Slave City" because I feel like the city has become a city of slaves, and folks who constantly capitulate, and it's very interesting, brother. We have a city of people. I have a comrade who years ago said to me, in the Black Panther Collective, he said, "You know what's going to happen to our people?" He said, "Our people are going to be the doormen and garbage men." Of this city and of this country. So we're going to be the permanent servant class. And if you come to New York City now, every time you come back, you see the black and quote-unquote Latino people are in further service of the white population of this city. And there's been an influx of white folks from the Midwest and from the South. And they seem to be completely at ease with this setup of black nannies and black folks who work purely in service industries and are not really a part of the culture and goings on of the city.
I mean, it sounds like South Africa.
It is an apartheid.
Under apartheid.
It is an American apartheid. Absolutely.
But the only difference is you figure that because you can get an iPhone that somehow you're not part of the underclass.
Exactly. You have a bunch of folks who are walking around with Louis Vuitton bags and a Yankee cap, a Yankee shirt, and some Yankee whatever. And they feel like that makes them, the fact that they're able to buy some gadgets, that they're part of the same thing. Whereas a lot of the young white folks who are moving into New York, their parents are able to subsidize them because they are recolonizing native lands for fracking and ethanol. So that's how they're funding themselves, and they can live in New York.
Like I said, man, you know, we got to do this again because you're deep. You know, you go exactly into those corners that need to be gone into. What, you know, Franz Fanon was trying to put forward, you need to really check him out at Fanonian on Twitter.com because he's the real deal. You know, thanks, man. You know, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it. And I want everybody to go check out his work at thestoicjournal.blogspot.com. So, Malachi Daniels, man, you know, thank you for being on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Absolutely. All power to the people.
All power to the people, man. You know, you've been listening to an interview with Malachi Daniels, writer, poet, illustrator, street activist, unorthodox Muslim, old school hip-hop head and hardcore Fanonian dietitian, revolutionary love for the people. You've heard the man. You've heard his words. Go out there and do the work, meaning think. Peace.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
The European came into Africa as a guest and was treated as a guest. The Africans, unsuspected, political, naive, some of them still are, because he had nothing against the Europeans and he had never enslaved any Europeans. He just assumed automatically no European would enslave him. He had never dealt with anyone who would enslave the host and the wife who cooked the meal and lie about it. Around 1442, the first slaves would be taken out of West Africa. Spain and Portugal goes to the Pope, the leading arbitrator of that day, the one person in Europe with the greatest authority. The Pope would say to Spain and Portugal, you take the East and you take the West, and you two good Catholic nations start fighting among yourselves. And then the profound statement before departure, you are both authorized to reduce to servitude all infidel people. The slave trade now had been sanctioned. The Europeans had been told they need not feel guilty of it because you're doing this to an infidel who is outside of God's grace. England went into the slave trade with a vengeance, led by Captain Hawkins and the good ship Jesus. The ship was called the Good Ship Jesus. The coat of arms on the ship was two Africans bound back to back with their arms tied. So they saw no contradiction in being in the slave trade and being Christians at the same time. We cannot deal with this enough because we're still suffering from this. inside of the mind of a lot of people in this world, into the millions. We are outside of humanity, outside of the grace of God. That's a terrible feeling as you walk the earth, because what has been taken away is your essential humanity, your human beingness. When they take away your human beingness, they take away your nationness. Early in the 19th century, the concept of slavery began to yield to the concept of colonialism, a more sophisticated form of slavery. Slavery as a system became unwieldy, and besides, as points for it, it was saturated. Everybody who wanted a slave had one, who could afford one. The European nations of size that did not have any portion of Africa began to grumble. At the Berlin Conference, 1884 and 1885, the European powers of substance, who did not have any part of Africa, now were given some part. Anti-colonial wars started up down the coast of West Africa, parts of Inner Africa, and in the Congo. There was armed resistance. The Zulu Wars lasted from the 1650s, when the Boers arrived, to the last Zulu War was 1906. In Ghana, the Ashanti Wars lasted from early in the 18th century to the last Ashanti War, led by a woman, Ye Asantewa, in 1900. For a while, it looked as though the Europeans would not be able to hold on to the continent. More manpower and more ruthless treatment brought it mainly under their control. From the first dynasty to the invasion of Nile Valley, that was the first golden age. When we read the biography of the Greek, he says, I am a child of Imhotep. And from the 18th dynasty came the world's great social reformer and maybe one of the world's first deities, Akhenaten. He thought so much of life, he would not crush a flower. He outlawed warfare. Spirituality was a part of the total life of the people. Before the coming of the Europeans, the African was very religious. The step pyramid was originally built with a temple at the top where you can go up and pray. This relates not just to the glorification of a pharaoh, but the spiritual outpouring of a people. This is what made the civilization of the Nile so great. The first show of European intelligence was a book called The Odyssey and the Iliad. That's about 850 B.C. Where is Egypt, 850 B.C.? Egypt is old and tired and has gone through 24 dynasties. It is on the eve of its last great dynasty that will come from the pharaohs in the south. And the Europeans have just written a book of folklore. I call the 25th dynasty the one dynasty from the south that moved up north and to tell their cousins, the Egyptians, how to rule a nation one more time. In the great show of history, this was Africa's last walk in the sun. It was a great, mighty walk. That walk had lasted 10,000 years. Now it's coming to an end. Europe is just being born. The very word Europe is not even being used.
This is Radio Anguindian. Anguindian Radio for the Fourth World.